and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, D.C. We're going to be talking to a number of folks who've come to the conference to talk about this healthcare bill. Now, understand, the Republicans have done their best, taken their best shot to destroy what little healthcare reform has gone on in the country, and not to make light of it. The healthcare reform that was passed last year is a huge, massive, major accomplishment, 100 years in the making. But yet, here's the thing, you know, they want to take even that away. And today we're going to talk about how this bill is going to affect workers, how this bill is going to affect senior citizens, how's it going to affect all of us. You know, before the 2010 election, I wanted the Republicans to run on the idea of taking something away, taking health care away from working people, to do what they did. They put out HR number one. Their number one priority was to repeal the job-killing, destroying, mutilating health care bill law. And they did that. They had their political ploy. They had their moment in the sun. They had that destructive moment. And I hope now they're going to pay. I hope they pay the price for it, because there has to be a price for this. And as we're going to talk about today, you know, moving forward, what does this law mean? What does this act mean? What are we going to get? How is it going to change? What are the hopes? What are the thoughts going into this? Because the next step in all of this is setting up the exchanges, setting up the things that each state is required to do. Because all the governors, they want the money. Corbett himself, he wants the money. You know, he's going to destroy adult basic, but he's going to want that cash as well. So the next step will be, what do we do with that? How do we move toward building these exchanges that are going to, I really truly believe, help people, going to give people an option to get into and to get health care from? Now there's going to be a lot of fighting, a lot of discussion, and that's good. That's what our democracy is about. That's what we're supposed to do. And I'm hoping that conversation is had, especially here today at the healthcare conference by Families USA. You know, I go back to some of my own healthcare thoughts on this, some of the stories that I've shared with you in the past, some of the things that have happened to me in the past. And look, you know, I think back all of my experiences, and yeah, we have a very good healthcare system, and some would even say we have a great system if you can afford it. If you have the insurance, if you have the ability to pay for it. You know, to be middle class in this country, you absolutely, unequivocally have to have health security. However that happens, and while we're having this discussion on this particular law and where to move forward, I do believe at the end of the day, every one of us, we want the same things. We want to make sure our kids are taken care of. We want to make sure that we're taken care of in old age, that we have the ability to see the doctor when we need one, that if we're unlucky enough to get cancer, that we don't lose our homes, that we don't go bankrupt. To me, that's the end destination. How do we get there? Personally, and as I've said a number of times, I am a strong supporter of the single-payer option. something like Vermont is working on right now with their exchange. And the good thing about this law for the state's rights people, for my tenthers, if you will, this gives the states a lot of control to experiment with how they're going to want things done. And what's going to be interesting is, you know, in moving forward, how that's going to work itself out. It's going to be interesting in seeing how each state comes up with their particular plan and what best practices will be part of that. So we're hoping for that. And you know, I think back to when, you know, a whole bunch of these stories from my years have popped into my head. I think about when my daughter broke her arm and the bills that came out of that. I think about, you know, the worry that came from that. And without health insurance, without that policy, we got the care she needed, and in a timely manner, and I give them all the credit in the world. The doctors were terrific. The emergency room was terrific. But when I started getting the bills, a broken arm, $12,000. That's what the bills were. And, I, you know, there were some complications along with it, but still $12,000 for a broken arm. I don't know many families that can afford that. So as we're talking about health care, we're talking about health insurance reform, which is really what this bill is about. It's about reforming how health insurance is provided in this country or how it's sold. Think about how it's going to affect your family. How's it going to affect me? How am I going to benefit from this? And understand, there are clear benefits here. Is it the greatest bill? No. Can we move forward? Absolutely. And I'm hoping we do, which is why now that the Republicans have done their ploy, we've had the dog and pony show. They did their little presentation. They spent a couple of days wasting taxpayers' dollars doing something that even they admit is going to amount to nothing. Now that we've had this little theater, where do we go from here? Where are there solutions to make things better? You know, it's nice to throw out platitudes. It's nice to throw out these campaign slogans. But at the end of the day, it's about governing. And I go back to the campaign where Tom Corbett was, on one hand, suing the federal government, saying it's unconstitutional to mandate health care. But on the other hand, on his same campaign website, saying that it's the best thing for Pennsylvania. That, to me, that speaks volumes. Now, we don't know what the governor is going to do. We don't know which direction he's going to take in setting up these exchanges. That's going to be coming in the months to follow. I'm eagerly awaiting that. But what we do know what he's already done. He's already gone after destroying adult basic and replacing that with a much, much more expensive plan for people who, to be honest, can't afford health care to begin with. So if you can't afford it now, tripling the price of it by destroying a government program, not the greatest idea in my opinion. Now, again, we the taxpayers are going to be held up on this, again, because of bad ideological policy by the people sitting in our halls of power. And you know, that's something that come election time we will have to remember. It's something we're going to have to go and talk about again. Because I think you're going to, as we move down the road, as we see what Governor Corbett does, we are going to front and center see his priorities. And when the budget comes out here in another month and a half or so, we are going to see the priorities. You know, the other day he came out with his reform package, which I thought was interesting. If you remember, during the campaign, day one, the reform package was supposed to be on the table. Day one came and went. Day two came and went. And here it took him over a week to get his package on the table. Kind of makes you wonder about that as well. Now, look, in talking about this, going back to this healthcare exchange thing, how is it that a guy who's fighting tooth and nail, fighting vehemently to deny you the access to this bill, what's he going to do to set this up? What kind of an exchange are we looking for? And I would point to the folks in Vermont. I would point to the folks in California, even Utah. They've set up their exchanges. What are we going to do? What's going to be in it for us? Because at the end of the day, this guy that we've put in there, he's either going to have to govern or he's going to have to get out. And what's really frustrating to me is we've put a whole bunch of anti-government people in charge of setting up something that I think will be good for us in the long run, will be positive and give us a choice. Because it is about competition. You know, you want to talk about, you know, the right loves to talk about, oh, we need to compete. But we don't want to compete with the big insurers. I say let it fall where it may, and we'll pick up the pieces from there. And I think you and I, the consumers, I think we'll be the ones who benefit from this. And again, you know, I go back to my original view. If we had a single payer system, I'll open up Medicare. Let me buy into it. Tell me how much it's going to cost me. Let me secure my family that way. That seems to be the best way, in my opinion. But you know, as Winston Churchill said, you know, Americans do the right thing always after trying everything else first. So we're going to try this first, I think. And as we move forward through this journey, I hope you'll be involved, because there's a lot of opportunities to be involved along the process. And we will be doing that right here. So we're going to be here at the Families USA Conference. Today we'll be playing all recorded interviews. If you miss any part of them, they're at thericksmithshow.com. We look forward to being back in the studio on Monday evening. So I hope you enjoy the interviews. I hope they're informative. And I hope they encourage you to get involved and get active, because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to shape the policy going forward and to shape our future as we move forward. So have a great night. We'll see you back live in the studio Monday and tomorrow night from Families USA.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public services and the public worker wages and pensions that make them possible are manageable, sustainable, and are not a burden that taxpayers can no longer afford. That's not coming from a union spokesman. Those are the views of the Fiscal Policy Institute's Dr. James Parrott.
There's no question about it. We have severe budget problems, but I think it's manageable. It's essential to maintain these as part of the retirement security safety net. We can maintain the integrity and the value of public pensions as an essential part of the retirement security system. There's clearly an opportunity to ask high-income people in New York to contribute their fair share to a solution. The public sector unions will do their part.
Dr. Parrott says slashing government spending will actually hurt the economic recovery.
If the response at this point is to really put the screws to state government budgets to cut that spending, to lay off public sector workers, that's only going to keep us mired in this severe economic downturn for that much longer.
States are continuing to struggle with ways to bridge massive budget deficits, and it's often falling on workers to take the brunt of the cuts. Jesse Russell reports.
Kansas is one of a number of states trying to figure out how to close a major budget deficit. That state is staring down a $550 million deficit, and a new plan from a legislative panel could see state workers taking it in the wallet to help close the gap. The proposal would see a 7.5% pay cut for state workers over the next handful of months leading up to the end of the fiscal year. As a result, the state would save $8 million. Organizations representing state workers have expressed concerns with the proposed plan, saying it comes at a time when more social services are needed due to the very same financial collapse in the private sector that created the budget shortfall in the first place. Meanwhile, a proposal in New York State to freeze state worker pay may have received a boost from a Quinnipiac University poll. According to the poll, 75% of voters said they agree with the wage freeze plan by Governor Andrew Cuomo. The plan would see workers' wages frozen for 1 year in an attempt to cut costs. However, that's mostly it for public support of Cuomo's plans. 79% are against cutting school aid, 69% want to leave Medicaid untouched, and 55% said hands-off pensions. Voters also want taxes left alone, with 66% opposing increases. 60% said they would prefer the elimination of services over a tax increase.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say, revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. We're here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference here in Washington, D.C. Sitting here with me is Dr. Hugh Hill, professor at Johns Hopkins University, former Clinton administration Medicare advisor. Dr. Hill, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Rick.
You know, I look at this conference, and this is a great opportunity to highlight the fact that we do need healthcare reform badly in the country, and we need to move forward, and I think this is a good place to talk about what's been done and where we go from here.
Absolutely, and I'm afraid we still are suffering from a false comparison between what people are afraid the changes will bring and what they imagine the current situation to be. What we really need to be doing is comparing the real future, the real predictable future, with what will happen if we don't act.
And that's an important point because, you know, I, as a small business owner and someone who looks at healthcare costs, 10 years from now, you look at the last 10 years, what does 10 years from now hold for businesses?
I remember when I was working on what was sometimes derogatorily called the Hillary healthcare plan back in 1992 and 93, and when that went down to a crushing defeat, we said, well, if you don't like this, you're going to like what the free market does to you a lot less, and I'm afraid the same thing can be said now.
Let's go back to that for a second. You know, where do you think we would be had that we had some action back when Hillary tried to get something done?
I think we would have had some rationality in the system. Right now what we've got is so irrational. I'm an emergency physician, and in my shift yesterday I had people that were really suffering in my waiting room for hours and hours and hours because there's just no place in the hospital to put them. So we are rationing health care now. We are using the R word, and we're doing it in an irrational way. The people that can wait for hours and hours get care, and the people that don't, don't.
Well, isn't that really a, you know, if the free market's supposed to take care of everything, which is what I'm told, wouldn't we have better emergency response? Wouldn't we have better access? You know, I look at my daughter when she was sick, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. There's only one place for me to go. That's the emergency room.
You want us to be there. We have in one sense, the emergency department's like a public good, like the fire department and the police department. You don't want to have to use us, but you sure as heck want us to be there when you need us.
But we're seeing a lot of them being closed down.
Yes. In the past decade, there's probably been 500 emergency rooms lost, while the demand for emergency services has shot up dramatically. We're probably at 120 million visits per year right now in the United States.
How much of that? You know, I hear this a lot, especially in Pennsylvania, this talk of, you know, people use the emergency room as their primary care physician. You know, how much of that do you actually see? People coming in when they could have gone to a physician of their own, how much of that do you see?
We see an enormous amount of it, but there's a little bit of a misunderstanding, if I may try to explain about that, Rick. There are people who have primary care physicians but can't get in to see them. There are people that have primary care physicians whose insurance companies might not authorize a visit for them. There are people who are frightened, who are sick, who need to be seen more quickly than their primary care physician can see them. So some of them have help. They just don't have it in a prompt way. In Massachusetts, when they instituted health care reform, the number of ED visits shot up by 7% almost immediately, indicating that there is a backlog of demand and expectations and need for health care that wasn't being fulfilled.
So if you wanted to argue the free market position, wouldn't something like what former Governor Rendell wanted to do in Pennsylvania, to be able to split between what's truly an emergency and what, you know, what could be just a regular doctor visit at the point that someone walks into the emergency room, where you have, for instance, a nurse practitioner. Like my daughter, she got sick. She had a little ear infection, flu, that kind of stuff. We didn't need to see an emergency room doctor. We could have seen someone to give her an antibiotic and have everything cleared up like that. Do we really need to? I guess it's just my question is the way we use our resources.
Absolutely. Right now, one of the ways that the emergency department is used is the backup, the bottom rung of the safety net, if you'll pardon me hashing metaphors. We are happy to serve in that position. We're proud of it, but it gets to be pretty damned expensive.
Right.
Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, federal law, requires that emergency departments screen for and not release anybody who's got an unstable medical condition. So what that gets translated into is big workups for everybody that comes to the emergency room to make absolutely sure we're complying with federal law. It's very hard to get out of an emergency room without being checked for all of those possibilities, because that's the standard of care. That's what we do. We worry about the worst things that could happen. If there were alternative services available that you could have taken your daughter to, I'm sure you would have availed yourself of them.
And that brings me to an interesting point. The President of the State of the Union talked about the possibility of tort reform. Is this kind of what you're talking about? You know, doctors preventing what they call defensive medicine. I don't know how much of that is prevalent. I would think it's not as much as I'm being told, but I'm sure on a certain level it happens.
There are there's an enormous spectrum of estimates of the effect of malpractice. I'm an attorney as well as a physician, and have worked in this and published in it for a long time. And I can tell you that it is too close to the thoughts of the doctors that are treating you. You want them to be focused exclusively on what's in your best interest. When I'm worried about malpractice, I'm worried about what's in my best interest, my colleagues, and my hospitals. And that's the wrong motivation.
I agree. But, you know, at the end of this, what happens, since we have such a poor social safety net in this country, what happens to someone who is injured through, you know, whatever the cause may be? What happens to that person who... You know, if we do say no more medical malpractice, what happens to that person?
They get superb care in my emergency room. Whether you come in there or somebody that's injured that's undocumented, somebody that's injured that has absolutely no insurance, they'll get terrific care. And if they need to be admitted, they'll be admitted to my hospital. That's true throughout the United States. The cost of that is shifted to folks like you that do have insurance.
And that number, I'm told, somewhere around $1,000 a year, we pay in higher premiums.
I've seen a variety of estimates, some as high as that, a couple even higher. It's hard to estimate. When you think about the fact that the total cost of emergency care in the spectrum of American healthcare dollars is only about 3% of the total, it's hard to ascribe that much of a total of $7,000-$8,000 a year cost per person average. In the United States, being emergency medical care. But I do know that when you have a hospital that's only collecting about 20%, only able to get back 20% of what it's billing, it has to move that cost around in order to stay open. That's in part why so many emergency departments have closed. And unfortunately, they've closed in areas where there are underserved people who are most in need and most desperate for health care.
Well, how much of this do you think? Because one of my big... I guess pet peeves, if you will, is that we've moved away from community hospitals to mostly for-profit institutions. And I would love to see going back to the days where the community owned the hospital and it wasn't a for-profit institution where shareholders benefited from someone's misfortune.
I appreciate the sentiment, but I'm afraid it would still be a problem. I think it would help things on the margin, but in general, those not-for-profit hospitals still have boards of directors that are telling the chief executive of the hospital, we've got to stay solvent so we can stay open. We cannot operate at a loss year after year after year. Where are we going to get the money to pay for this?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dr. Hugh Hill, professor at Johns Hopkins University, former Clinton administration Medicare advisor, you know, talking about Medicare, you know, with some of the things, the conversations that had come out about this health care bill, that we're going to be stealing from Granny. You know, the savings that they were talking about from Medicare, some $500 million, I guess, $500 billion, I guess, the president was saying, over the next 10 years. They're saying that we're taking health care away from rationing from Medicare. I'm curious your thoughts.
I disagree sharply with that. I may be one of the few people that's actually read most of the bill. I can't cite you chapter and verse, but if you look on the websites from reliable resources, including Families USA, about where the money's coming from in health care reform, you'll see that it's not coming from that.
Where are the savings coming from? They talk about this big number of all these savings. Where's that coming from?
The Medicare Advantage programs have been overfunded and overgenerous for some time. They are being cut back and brought into line with other health insurance so that they are not the boondoggle big win that they have been for both insurance companies and the people that have been able to afford them. Those are the supplemental plans you add on. Huge amount of the saving comes from that. And a lot of saving comes, and a lot of the money that's going to pay for this, quite frankly, does come from increased revenues. There are small bits and pieces, but a big chunk of the revenue comes from taxing as part of the Medicare tax my investment income. For couples that earn over $250,000 or individuals that earn over $200,000, if you'll pardon me getting in the weeds and being a little wonky, right now their income is taxed by Medicare. But under the bill, their investment income, not just from their labor, would also be taxed. And that's going to bring in a lot of money over the years.
Yeah, because it's something we're really not taxing right now.
Yes.
Interesting. You know, because, my grandmother called me frantically. You know, because she lives on a fixed income, like they say, and pretty close to the margin, and she was worried that they're going to take this away and they're going to take my Medicare. And it was really a good sales plan. I mean, they were on message, and they scared a lot of people.
I'm so sorry that your grandmother was frightened. That really is terrible that our dialogue and our debate has gotten to the point where we make political hay by frightening people.
And, But I guess that was the only way you could beat this back, was to scare people, to say, oh, the death panels, and we're going to ration care. And I got to be honest, I've already had care rationed. My insurance company has told me, no, you can't go do this.
That's the fallacy that a lot of people live under. They think that the current situation is not a ration system. It is. It's just irrationally rationed.
And I go back to this often. I tried to, to put down my grandmother's fear, saying, no, you're going to be all right. Call your congressman. Don't just be afraid of the TV. But I've met a lot of people who, boy, that just stuck with
it. It's unfortunate that works. But it is right and, I think, highly appropriate to be skeptical about insurance and insurance companies. There's a lot of talk about insurance companies in the bill and in the rhetoric about this, both pro and con. But just remember where the incentives are. Think like an economist for a minute. If you're a manufacturer, your profit margin is the difference between what it costs you to make something and what it costs you to sell it, what you bring in selling it. If you're an insurance company, your profit margin is the difference between what you take in as premium and what you pay out as benefits. And if you can keep the difference between those two numbers large, you make a lot of profit.
Yeah, I mean, in talking to that, one of the examples that I've cited is, if you had an insurance company who said, yeah, we're going to pay for all this stuff, they'd be out of business rather quickly. And I think Krugman had the best example. He was talking about amputations due to diabetes in his one book. And he said, the federal government pays for 95% of all amputations due to diabetes. So there's this incentive for insurance companies to push off care and to hold off care because ultimately you and I, the taxpayers, we're the ones who are responsible at the end of the road.
That's an excellent point, Rick. And it's also in the insurance company's interest to push it off because maybe people will be dissatisfied and go on to another insurance company. If they don't compete on prior existing conditions, they can compete on how bad the service is, and that way they get to keep the people that are good risks.
Last question I've got for you. We're here at this Families USA conference. What are you doing here today?
I'm happy to be here to answer questions and hoping that we can keep, as the Republicans start beating up on this bill, we can keep the nature of emergency medicine as an essential service.
Dr. Hugh Hill, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Just make your head up.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference here in Washington, D.C. Sitting here with Don Berwick, administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. Don, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Rick. Thank you.
Yeah, I look at this conference. I think it's a great conference, bringing people together to talk about how we move forward with regard to making sure that people's lives are secure with regard to healthcare. Your thoughts on the conference?
Families USA is a wonderful organization, and they've been really, really helpful in making sure that Americans have access to the care that they want and need. I'm happy to be here.
Here's the thing. I did some research on you earlier on, and the first thing that pops up is the death panels thing, the discussion about rationing health care, this idea that somehow this bill or any bill moving forward was going to do that. And I'm curious your thoughts of some of the rhetoric and some of the discussions that have been going on around that.
Yeah, there's so much misinformation out there, Rick. I'm glad you're asking the question. The Affordable Care Act, this new bill, it's an amazing bill. It's offering Americans what they want. It's guaranteeing to people that they can get the health care that they want and need. People with pre-existing conditions who can be denied health insurance coverage, which is sort of weird. I mean, if you need it, you can't get it from your insurance company. That's over. That's going to end now. By 2014, insurance companies can't deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. Already we've got a special program to help people with pre-existing conditions to get coverage they want. Americans want that. Kids under 26 now can be covered by their parents' policies. That's progress. State by state, exchanges are going to be set up so people can find health insurance that's affordable, and if they qualify, they can get subsidies to do that. We're working really hard to improve the quality of care. That's actually the way to get health care costs under control, by making the care better so it isn't fragmented, so people don't get lost, so errors don't happen, so infections don't happen. And the Affordable Care Act lets us do that. This is about making American health care better and stronger for people. And anybody who's telling you otherwise hasn't read the law.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, don't we have to talk about somehow, in using their term, rationing, somehow making sure that care is available to the folks who need it? And is there any discussion on that? Because there are, and some of the things that I was looking at is, cost-benefit analysis. That I think that's where they're taking this rationing from.
The rhetoric's highly misleading. I mean, I abhor rationing. There's no call for that. People can have, in our country, at the levels of expenditure we have, and even less, all the care that they really want and need. We can guarantee that to them. We just have to build a care system that's capable of giving them that. If we don't, that's wasteful. That drives the costs up when things go wrong. So the whole agenda here is about making health care better, not withholding care from people. And the people who are claiming that it's about withholding care, they're not on the right wavelength. They're misinforming people. And I hope the public can come to realize this law is about making their care better, and it will.
You know, we hear often that we have the best delivery system in the world, and sometimes I question that by some of the things that some of the hoops you have to jump through to get certain tests you need. Is this going to address some of that, streamline some of the practices?
Sure. I mean, we have reason to be very proud of the American healthcare system in a lot of ways. We were innovators. We invent many of the new pharmaceuticals that the world depends on. We've got very good high-tech care. You're lucky to be here in some cases. But like all countries, we have pretty big defects in our care system. Ask someone with chronic illness. Ask someone who has congestive heart failure and a little bit of lung disease what their life is like, and they'll report the care system's fragmented. One doctor doesn't know what the other one's doing. They go in and out of the hospital, and nobody communicates back with their local doctor. Well, that's a fragmented system. That's an expensive system and a defective one. Now, the new law lets us help the delivery systems of the country build all these really much better patterns of care for people, integrated care, coordinated care. That just means somebody's got your back. Medical homes, health homes, accountable care organizations, those are all jargon. But in that law, what that means is that we as a country can help people get a home base for their care and make sure that's well supported so they're not going to get lost, and that'll be better care for them.
Yeah, I agree. One of the big arguments was, I've heard this ad nauseum, that I don't want the government between me and my doctor. And it drives me nuts. Because I've got a health insurance company right between me and my doctor.
Yeah.
I guess the frame that I'm getting is that, everything's just wonderful the way it is now. And I guess we do have the best health care system in the world if I can reach in my pocket and pay for it with cash.
We're on the same wavelength. I don't want the government between me and my doctor or between you and your doctor. We have to stay out of that encounter. That has to be honored, the privacy and the dignity. We want to give doctors and patients the opportunity to work together to do exactly what they want to do, which is to find the help, to be together. And no, that we need to make sure that that's possible. In a fragmented system where people can't find insurance, where the information systems aren't proper, where things get lost, where there's no reward for quality, well, then the doctor and the patient have trouble doing what they really are there to do. And my job in CMS is to make that as possible as I can. I want people to find each other and the doctors and the patients and the nurses and to work together as well as I know they really want to.
You know, and looking at a national health, and this is not a national health system, but, you know, one of the knocks is that people will go to the doctor more often. And personally, I think that's not a bad thing, that people are going to the doctor more often. I think I wish we had a more preventative system instead of reacting to illness, so that we prevented things a little bit better. But, you know, what do you think of that?
Well, first, you're right about prevention. In this new law, the Affordable Care Act, here's something people may not know. Prevention, for the first time, is really covered under this Affordable Care Act. In Medicare, for the elders in our country, up until this act, there was no coverage for an annual wellness visit. Now there is. First dollar coverage. When you see your doctor for your annual checkup, that's covered. Flu vaccine's covered. Colonoscopy, mammography, screening tests are now covered. All that's with this new law. So the investment in prevention is really there. In terms of people abusing the system, well, there's fraud in the system. That's not patients. Those are criminals out there. And this new law is very strong on stopping those abuses. But I don't think people go to the doctor as a recreational activity. They're there because they need to be there, and we need to help them make sure that they can see their doctor when they want to see them.
Yeah, I have one of those Cadillac health care plans that the Republicans seem to name my health care as a Cadillac plan. And I think I used it once last year.
Yeah, you'd rather be home with your loved ones than in a doctor's office or a hospital bed. And we want to keep you at home. I mean, another thing in this new law that is really exciting is all the emphasis we're putting now on home-based services, transitions to the community. We like patients, we don't want people in hospitals. They don't need to be there. We want them home. But that means you have to change the payment system and the reward system to reward improvements in care that keep you healthy. Right now, the system before this law is very oriented toward volume. You get paid more by doing more. I think the payment should go along with quality. And this system, the new law, really has all sorts of wonderful opportunities in it to reward doctors and hospitals for keeping patients healthy, which is what we want in the first place.
I agree. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Don Berwick, administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Don, you know, I go back to some experiences that I've had in talking about a fragmented system. My in-laws were terminally ill years ago, and rushing from doctor to hospital, all of this stuff, it seemed like the Keystone Cops for a while, where you're going from different places, different tests, and redoing tests and all of this stuff. In this bill, how much of this addresses that? Can we streamline this system?
Definitely. Yeah, it's all about coordination. Think of it. If you're really healthy, well, then you're not going to be in healthcare very much. But a lot of Americans have diseases or conditions they're going to live with for a long time, or like the story you told, someone in your family who needed continuum of care. Well, understand, the way we pay for care now, it's all in pieces. We pay a hospital for a admission. We pay a doctor for a test. We pay a laboratory for a test. We pay a home health care person for a visit. Well, that's not a journey. You needed a journey with your loved one. You needed to know that there was someone helping you through this period of their lives with chronic illness or serious illness.
But some would say that you're marching us right to euthanasia. And I've heard this argument a thousand times. The government's going to put somebody, and they're going to talk you into committing suicide. Well, really? Are you that insane? And there are some that have had this argument.
That's just silly talk. It's not the case. The whole idea here is to honor the relationship between the doctor and the patient so that they can do what they want to do. So they reach the decisions and use the resources that they want to use. And we need to make that possible. Don't believe the misinformation. This is about making care better, and it's really about giving patients power, giving the people who get the care the right to make the choices, to control what happens to them, and to work with the professionals who want to help them do that. That's what this is about, no matter what stage of your life you're in.
You know, my grandmother called me frantic during the health care debate. They're stealing money from Medicare. Medicare is going to be gone. Now, there's a lot of talk of saving money from Medicare. Where's that money coming from, and how is that going to benefit the system long term?
Well, overall in the country, we better find a way to help reduce health care costs or the rate of rise of those costs, because they're driving us over a cliff economically. That's not about Medicare. That's about everything. My belief is the way to reduce costs is to improve the care, as we've been saying. When care is smooth and continuous, when your doctor gets to focus on your needs, when you can have the medicines you want and you need, then the care is going to be much less expensive. But on the whole, this bill makes Medicare stronger. It's going to be there longer. Do you know, before we passed this bill, it was predicted by the government officials that oversee this that the Medicare Trust Fund, which is a trust fund just like you might have for your grandchildren, the Medicare Trust Fund was going to go bankrupt in 2017. Just as a result of this law, right now, the life of that trust fund is extended 12 years. Now it's estimated 2029, and that gives us a little bit of a window here to work even harder to make sure that Medicare is sustainable. So, no, Medicare got stronger with this bill, not weaker.
Yeah, but, you know, the rhetoric out there is that you're taking money from it. I think it was, they talked about $500 billion or something over a 10-year period that's being taken from this. Am I wrong here?
It's not a takeaway. It's a reduction in cost by improvement, and that's what your grandmother and others should understand. This isn't about withholding things. This is about making the care better so it's less expensive. Let's give you an example. Infections in hospitals. If your loved one goes into a hospital.
Both of them did.
They got infections?
Both. There sepsis in both occasions.
Sepsis. All right. Well, here's what we know about sepsis. It can be prevented. We know how to prevent it. There are hospitals around this country that have done away with hospital infections, driven certain infections to zero risk. Not all hospitals do that, though. In fact, most right now don't. Well, that infection that your loved ones get is costing extra money and hurting them. Improvement means stop the infections. Make the care better. Reward the hospital for making the care better. Let them share in some of the gains. Costs go down, health goes up. That's the agenda here. That's the way to do it. Not taking things away from people, making their care better. Everyone knows that in every other walk of their life, that you buy a defective product, it's going to cost you more in the long run.
Yep,
so
absolutely.
Do it right the first time. And absolutely. This law helps us do that. It rewards hospitals for doing things right. It helps doctors learn more. There's forms of outreach and assistance. We have a new innovation center in this law, a wonderful thing. An investment in innovation in the whole country on innovations in care that reduce costs and improve quality. Innovations like preventing the sepsis that your loved ones had.
Now, let me last question I have for you, and it's back to this whole idea of the quote unquote death panels. There are specific groups going to be set up to look at cost benefit analysis, to look at streamlining things, of course.
We need science. I mean, let's say you come to me and you have a disease, and there are two ways to treat you. Wouldn't you and I both like to know which is the better way? Well, that comes from science. That's evaluating what works and what doesn't. We should be investing a lot in that. Why would we do something for you that doesn't work when something's available that does? So don't confuse that with rationing or anything else. That's just understanding what works and what doesn't. There's a lot of that. You understand, in the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, we're not actually allowed to take costs into consideration when we decide what we're going to cover and what not. We can't do that. Now, insurance companies can do that.
Sure.
And you just don't know they're doing it. And so turning the lights on there and holding them more accountable for the decisions they're making, making sure that their resources are going into care, that's an important part of the law. We're doing that.
And I think that was a big part of this whole discussion we've had over health care, because I don't think anybody knew what rescission was. They know now.
Yeah, rescission is it's so weird, you think it might not happen, but it's like you buy insurance because you might need the care, and then if you do need the care, they take away your insurance. That becomes illegal under this law. Now, don't you want that? And aren't we misinforming ourselves to think that it would be better not to have this law? Oh, no, this law is good for us.
Don Baruch, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kathleen Stoll from Families USA.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we
switch to Capital Blue Cross. To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capitalbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. We're at the Families USA Conference here in Washington, D.C., talking about health care. I'm here with Kathleen Stoll, Deputy Executive Director.
That's right.
Of Families USA. Kathleen, thank you for taking time for me.
I'm glad you could be here to join us.
This is a wonderful conference. Thanks for having us. Tell me a little bit about what's going on here today.
Well, we bring about 600 to 700 people from across the country here into Washington, D.C. Last year, we had even more folks who came in, and, you know, it was right after the Massachusetts election, and we were all wondering what was going to happen with the health care reform law that we were trying to pass at that time. This year, we have 600 to 700 folks today, about 1,000 folks tomorrow, and we're all here celebrating together the fact that we passed the Affordable Care Act, and then taking a deep breath and thinking about what we need to do over the next year to educate the public about all the benefits in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, it's about moving forward, and in talking about moving forward, making it better. Because, you know, a lot of people that I talk to on both sides of the aisle, not happy with it. There's an opportunity, I think, to move forward and make things and make some improvements that I think are going to be needed over the years.
Well, that's a good point. One of the senators that spoke with us this morning, Senator Harkin, actually, I believe it was, used the example or the analogy of a starter home. You build a starter home, you want it to have a solid foundation, but you're always looking forward to what kind of an addition can you put on it, how can you improve it. One of the things he mentioned is one of the additions we think we can get, given a little time, might be some stronger public plan options, which may be of interest to some of your listeners. But, you know, right now, we got to make sure we don't dismantle the starter home.
Right.
We got to keep it in place, and we're under a lot of attacks.
Because the Republicans are trying to burn it down.
You bet. You bet. So we all have to be sort of the volunteer fire department for the Affordable Care Act, make sure that we're bringing common sense and dousing the fires with, you know, just common sense and the facts. A lot of spinmeisters in the world say, don't use the facts, use emotion. Well, I think you need to use both. And we have the facts on our side, and we have the emotion and the moral prerogative on our side. This is good policy, and it's good for people. And I think what we need to do is help people understand what the facts are. I mean, we're still talking about death panels in this country, and that is a lie. We need to move past that. What we should be talking about is that people will not be discriminated against because they're not in perfect health. They'll be able to buy insurance. People with pre-existing conditions will be able to buy insurance. People who have children, 20 children, I should say young adults, up to 26 can keep them on their plans. We've added new benefits to the Medicare program. I could go on and on. The protections from the abuses of insurance companies that we have built into this Affordable Care Act are tremendous.
And that should be the focus. I mean, we've allowed the insurance companies, we've allowed the industry to take us down a path. it's been a not a really great path because we look at the abuses that have happened. And, you know, I keep going back to this rescission thing that most people before this debate never knew existed. Now, thanks to this discussion, not only the discussion, but the law, no longer going to happen.
Well, a lot of people don't know that when they have, before this law, before today, you know, if you had breast cancer and you thought you had insurance, it could easily have been ripped out from under you. We have stories in our story bank here at Families USA, stories of women who thought they had breast cancer, folks who thought they had thyroid cancer, knew they had breast cancer, thyroid cancer, and their insurance companies found reasons to rescind their policies, leave them with no coverage, even though they paid premiums over the years based on, you know, innocent mistakes on an application form. That is no longer going to happen. The Affordable Care Act makes sure that people know when they pay premiums, they'll get their insurance. It'll be there when they need it, and it covers the things they need and won't be full of loopholes, so you end up bankrupt even though you do have insurance. That's the old way. The new way under the Affordable Care Act is that insurance companies will have to treat consumers fairly.
You know, personally, I was a big fan of single payer. This was never going to be that, I don't think, because I do believe there's some benefit in having a policy that follows you from cradle to grave so that you're not pushing people off onto someone else, i.e. me, the taxpayer. Because, as, you know, I look at a lot of the folks that I know. My father-in-law, for instance, has diabetes. His private insurance company kept pushing off his testing supplies, kept pushing off treatment until he's finally on the back of Social Security, of Medicare, and now he's on the back of the taxpayer. And at some point, we have to take away those incentives to push it down the road.
Well, you have to think about the Affordable Care Act as being a new federal law that provides for a lot of creativity at the state level. In fact, right now, across the country, all 50 states, there are a range of decisions they have to make about what these new exchanges, this very regulated marketplace, will look like in their states. I've been spending some time with advocates in Vermont. And Vermont's where I think we're going to see how far you can go within the flexibility of the Affordable Care Act to design a system that meets the needs of the folks in Vermont. And they're talking about some things that take you a long way down the road to the kind of system you're talking about, where you really have use a negotiated bid process to make sure that the players who are offering insurance are offering the best possible price. You're regulating what they offer and how they offer it. And I won't tell you that it will be a pure single-payer model that we'll see emerge in Vermont, but the exchange structure in the Affordable Care Act gives you a lot of room to move very far down that road.
You know, I look at states like ours here in Pennsylvania. We've got a governor who was one of the people who signed on as Attorney General to fight the constitutionality of the law. Yet, on the other hand, he's going to be the guy in charge of setting up this exchange. And there's some concern there.
We have a number of states, call them red states, politically conservative states, where the governors and the attorney generals are making a lot of noise about opposing the Affordable Care Act. They've signed on to the lawsuit in Florida. But what we also see, frankly, is that within state government, there are a lot of very good people who are moving forward and moving forward very quickly to look at the range of decisions they need to make to put this law into place in their states in a way that works for their states. I'll give you an example. Governor Mitch Daniels, Indiana.
Yeah.
His rhetoric is opposition to the Affordable Care Act. He signed on to the lawsuit. But he has been quoted in the papers saying, I can't afford to not move forward and think about the possibility that this law of the land will remain the law of the land, and how should it look in Indiana. The folks in Indiana need him and his administration to move forward or they'll get left behind. If they get left behind, what do they lose? All those protections from the abuses of insurance companies we were just talking about, Rick, plus there will be robust, substantial help with the purchase of coverage, with the cost of premiums available to people in 2014. And that's for families up to an income of like $90,000 a year. This is not just a low-income program, but a moderate-income program. People still have to pay some out-of-pocket, but they will have substantial help, so insurance is affordable. If governors don't move forward to put their exchanges in place, the citizens of their state will not get their premium subsidies. And middle-class families deserve that help.
I absolutely agree. And it's interesting you bring that up. with Governor Daniels, because during the election in Pennsylvania, Governor at the time, candidate Corbett, on his website was, you know, touting the fact that as Attorney General, he had signed on to this lawsuit and thought it was unconstitutional. But in another section of his website, said it would be the best thing for Pennsylvania. So, I mean, trying to figure out how those two fit together, and we're still going to see what our governor does, but kind of an interesting polar approach.
Well, you know, there's been, if I dare use the word, but hypocrisy involved in the fight of those who oppose the Affordable Care Act. The opponents are really, in many cases, saying one thing on one hand and turning around and saying another. And we see the double standard of members of Congress in the Republican Party who have many of the benefits that we are fighting to preserve in the Affordable Care Act for themselves through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan. They don't have to worry about pre-existing conditions. Members of Congress don't have to worry about their rescission of their plan. They don't have to worry about being charged more because they've had some health problem in the past. The benefits, and they actually get subsidies with the help of the cost of coverage. Those are things that they are saying they want to take away now,
right,
from the American people that was passed in the Affordable Care Act. And so some of us are saying, well, that's a double standard. Shut up or put up. If you don't want to preserve this law and you're fighting for repeal, maybe you should drop out or pass on getting the benefits that come with your office, and it's an office of trust that is supposed to be about the people, and not accept those same benefits through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan. You know, there's been a lot of wiggling around that. We've seen a couple members say they won't take up the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan, but they've got eight. We're up to eight. They've got backups. Either they have a spouse where they can source coverage, they're wealthy, or they, in a couple cases, I believe they're on the veterans. They have veterans coverage. So,
but I got a question: if they're on their spouse's benefits, because I know with my insurance, every year I've got to fill out a form that says my spouse doesn't have insurance for me to cover her.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting that, you know, maybe I would love to see if they're getting away with that.
Well, there's
because I know I couldn't.
Yeah. And there's a lot of employer-based plans now that actually require that you show that your spouse or family member doesn't have another source of coverage, and only then will they allow you onto their plans.
Yep.
You get in some employers are still not going through that process, so that varies. So yeah, and they're in most cases, folks. It depends on what kind of insurance you have, but a lot of folks are not going to be able to do that. They're not going to be able to get on their spouse's plan. But apparently, these members of Congress.
They're special.
Well positioned, shall we say.
They're special. Last line of questioning I have here, Kathleen Stoll. You know, in looking at this conference, what do you hope comes out of this? You know, you're going to have this, as you said, a kind of a celebration to talk about the act that was passed, find out, you know, kind of figure out where we go from here. Once everyone leaves here Friday, gets home on Saturday, where do you go from there?
Well, we have a network of very committed activists and advocates across the country, and we're thinking about what their mission or their tasks are. Our nuts and bolts policy at the state level to work out what an exchange can look like and make it as strong as possible so it leverages purchasing power to lower premiums. At the same time, we need those same folks to be carrying a public education message, going out into the forums, in the communities, telling people about the concrete benefits that are in the Affordable Care Act. And I think we need to talk to swing voters in this country. You know, there's a certain percentage of the country that's going to oppose this act, and they're not open to being educated. There's another portion of folks who understand it and are thrilled to see the benefits. We've got folks in the middle, and we need to really work with them and help them understand what's at stake. I think through that education, we can guarantee the preservation of the Affordable Care Act, and I think it will reflect well on the party that supported the Affordable Care Act, the Democrats, frankly.
I hope so. Hope that happens. Kathleen Stoll, I appreciate your time. FamiliesUSA.org is the website. We'll get a link at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Kathleen, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back right after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public services and the public worker wages and pensions that make them possible are manageable, sustainable, and are not a burden that taxpayers can no longer afford. That's not coming from a union spokesman. Those are the views of the Fiscal Policy Institute's Dr. James Parent.
There's no question about it. We have severe budget problems, but I think it's manageable. It's essential to maintain these as part of the retirement security safety net. We can maintain the integrity and the value of public pensions as an essential part of the retirement security system. There's clearly an opportunity to ask high-income people in New York to contribute their fair share to a solution. The public sector unions will do their part.
Dr. Parent says slashing government spending will actually hurt the economic recovery.
If the response at this point is to really put the screws to state government budgets to cut that spending, to lay off public sector workers, that's only going to keep us mired in this severe economic downturn for that much longer.
States are continuing to struggle with ways to bridge massive budget deficits, and it's often falling on workers to take the brunt of the cuts. Jesse Russell reports.
Kansas is one of a number of states trying to figure out how to close a major budget deficit. That state is staring down a $550 million deficit, and a new plan from a legislative panel could see state workers taking it in the wallet to help close the gap. The proposal would see a 7.5% pay cut for state workers over the next handful of months leading up to the end of the fiscal year. As a result, the state would save $8 million. Organizations representing state workers have expressed concerns with the proposed plan, say it comes at a time when more social services are needed due to the very same financial collapse in the private sector that created the budget shortfall in the first place. Meanwhile, a proposal in New York State to freeze state worker pay may have received a boost from a Quinnipiac University poll. According to the poll, 75% of voters said they agree with the wage freeze plan by Governor Andrew Cuomo. The plan would see workers' wages frozen for 1 year in an attempt to cut costs. However, that's mostly it for public support of Cuomo's plans. 79% are against cutting school aid, 69% want to leave Medicaid untouched, and 55% said hands-off pensions. Voters also want taxes left alone, with 66% opposing increases. 60% said they would prefer the elimination of services over a tax increase.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
At TheRickSmithShow.com. We're at the Families USA Conference here in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting here with Terry Gardner, National Policy Director for the Small Business Majority. Terry, thanks for sitting down with us.
Glad to be here.
You know, you look at this health care bill that was passed, the Republicans have repealed in the House. How is this going to help small businesses?
Well, a repeal is not going to help small businesses because that would just stick us with the existing system, which is failing small businesses. A lot of small businesses, you can no longer afford coverage for their employees and have dropped out. And those that are providing coverage, they're struggling and, you know, going year to year trying to figure out how to stay in the game and keep providing health benefits for their own family and their employees.
You know, I've met a number of small business owners over the last year who have talked about, you know, if costs could come down, they'd offer better insurance, or they would offer it all, because a lot of small businesses can't offer it now as is. This, in a way, is going to give them the opportunity, I think.
You know, we do a lot of research in our organization. We poll small businesses all over the country, you know, to get a real fix on what small business, and, you know, get away from all the political back and forth. And you know, what comes out is employers, especially small businesses, say, you know, I want to provide coverage to my employee. I need to be competitive with big companies, with government employers, but it's the cost. And so they want to provide it. They say, when we ask them, well, why do you want to provide coverage? They say, we need to recruit and retain the quality of employees we need to make our business successful. So they want to provide it, but it's got to be affordable. And, you know, and that's why we've worked on health reform, is we see a lot of pieces in this legislation that can help small business.
Yeah, and we hear the political rhetoric that, you know, small businesses are the job creators, that they're they're the engine of our economy, yet we're not doing much to help them. In a lot of veins, because you look at a lot of policies, they're aimed at the bigger corporations. The guys who employ 3, 4, 10 people, they seem to be, in my opinion, the ones left out of a lot of this discussion.
I can tell you that because I owned a small business for over 30 years. All my life I've been in business. I'm retired now, and I, you know, do work here with the small business majority advocating for small businesses. And you're right, the deck has been always stacked against small businesses, whether it's the regulations, the big companies getting in, writing things that, you know, work better for them than small businesses. Financing, same problem. You try to start up a company, you go in and they say, well, you don't have any experience, you don't have any track record, we can't loan you money. We saw in the recession here, who got hammered? It was all the small businesses on Main Street. You know, we get the economy going back, the bailout helps big. And it's the same thing on healthcare. Small businesses are paying, on average, 18% more for coverage than big businesses.
Well, why is that?
Because they don't have the bargaining power. If you're IBM or Microsoft, of course you're going to negotiate and they're going to pay attention to you. But, you know, the average small business, 80% of small businesses have under 10 employees. Now, you go in there and you say, I have 8 employees. I'd like to negotiate with you, Aetna.
There's the door.
Forget it. You just take what they give you. And that's why we, and this is a bipartisan bill, Republicans and Democrats for years have supported the idea of creating a small business exchange. You know, and a lot of small business owners we talked to are shocked to find, oh, you mean that's in the health care reform bill? Yes, it is. This was written by small business groups like NFIB with Senator Snow, Republican, from Maine, and Senator Lincoln, Democrat from Arkansas, and members of both parties wrote this small business exchange legislation. And, you know, we are working in states to get every state to set up an exchange. Utah already has an exchange. You know, Connecticut, they have the CBIA has an exchange. These things can work. They're proven models because when small businesses group together, then they're like a big business. They have leverage, you know, and that's what you need to get the best deal.
Well, it's like any risk pooling. The more people you have in the pool, the lower the output of costs will be.
Bingo. You hit it on the head. That's all this is. It's a pooling of small businesses. And Congress said, hey, we're going to support each state setting up an exchange. We think that makes sense. Let each exchange. You know, Pennsylvania is different than Alaska or California. So, yeah, let's let each state set up an exchange. The federal government's going to support doing that. They're giving grants to the states right now to go out and set up their exchange. But, you know, the local people know, you know, the local businesses, the local insurance market. Insurance is regulated at a state level. So this makes a lot of sense. And I think Congress was wise to say, okay, let's have state exchanges. And that's going to work in this huge country of ours with 50 different states.
Right. You don't want a one size fits all plan. My concern that is, though, if you're talking about breaking it up into 50 different plans, is that you have, like in our state, a governor who was adamantly opposed, filed a lawsuit as attorney general to rule the Health Care Act unconstitutional on one hand, yet on the other hand, he's out there destroying adult basic and moving things to a more private, more costly insurance for the folks who are on the low-income rolls.
Well, I got some good news for you. 48 states got a grant, including your state of Pennsylvania, to set up an estate exchange. So there's a lot of politics going on here between the two parties. But behind the scenes, the insurance commissioners are in almost every state are working to set up an exchange. There are exchange bills introduced by Republicans and Democrats in different states. I just saw in Texas, where their governor is opposing from, Republican legislators introduced a bill for exchange. So hopefully we can get this exchange discussion away from the electoral
politics, right.
and move forward. You know, there's Republican-run states like Utah have led the way. They've already set up an exchange. You know, Massachusetts, Democratic-run state, they set up their connector. You know, so we have lots of models to pick with and from.
We'll see what best practices come out of it, and hopefully we move to a better system.
Well, yeah, and, you know, and one of the other things we're finding that small businesses don't know about, only about a third of them know, is that there is a tax credit for small businesses, 35%. So a small employer, under 25 employees now, can qualify for a federal tax credit up to 35% of what they are paying to insure their employees. This is an incentive to help small businesses. And I think Congress, again, was wise, and you know, they understand the small businesses are really suffering in this recession. So, you know, it was going to take a while to get these exchanges. So let's help the small business. Here's a tax credit. It's 35% now. It goes up 50%. You know, it actually even covers nonprofit employers if they're small nonprofits.
Right.
Their employers, too, they have the same darn problem small businesses have.
And that's at 25 employees? Because I keep hearing this definition of small business as anything under 500. And I'm going, no, 500 employees, that doesn't seem like a small business to me.
Well, 500, that's the SBA division for getting loans.
Right.
So you can imagine how that got in there, right? I mean, when we talk small business, we really mean 100 and down. You know, I had a company that grew from a startup to where we had 1,000 employees. You know, well, anytime you're over 100, 500, that's a medium-sized company. And
right.
And you find that by that time, you've got an HR department. Things are, you know, you've got a lot more capacity to deal with insurance companies, to maybe self-insure, a lot more options. But 80% of the small businesses have under 10 employees. And that's who we really think has the biggest problem, pays the most for their insurance. But we also...
Because they're closest to the margin.
Yeah. And, you know, but we also, when we say small business, we don't want to forget there's 22 million self-employed entrepreneurs in this country. Think farmers. Think realtors. They don't work for that big real estate company. They're self-employed. They pay self-employment tax. They're on their own. They have to get their own insurance. And so all those farmers in Pennsylvania, all those realtors, Joe the plumber and Frank the electrician, you know, a lot of these people are self-employed. And they are suffering even more than the small employers. They even pay a higher rate of insurance. So we're trying to make sure that, you know, we really focus on how does this health insurance going to work for the 22 million self-employed and the 6 million small employers that have under 100 employees.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Terry Gardner, National Policy Director, Small Business Majority. You know, Terry, you know, it's interesting you brought that up, that... You know, you look at small business being the engine of growth in the country, and I thought that this bill would have been that thing that sparks the entrepreneurial spirit here in the country. I know several of my friends would love to start businesses of their own, can't afford to. And getting to this, you know, the ability of small businesses to come together and pool, I didn't know that was in the bill. That had been a Republican talking point for a long time, and it's just something that I've always agreed with. And I'm got to be honest, I didn't know that was in the bill.
Well, this is part of the problem. You know, you get an election, and we all know about politics, and this party's out of power, and that party wants to get in power. And, you know, that has really polluted the conversation about what's really in the bill and the real issue. You know, the real issue for small businesses is get me something I can afford
right.
that covers my people. You know, that's the bottom line here, and we really need to remain focused on this and let the politicians go play, you know, their baseball bats at election time and bash each other and criticize each other. You know, that's fine, and that's the American election method. But, you know, we just got to get back to what's the problem. And poll after poll by our organization or every business organization, I said for 10 years now, small businesses think their number one problem is health insurance. And what's the problem? It's the cost, you know.
And the uncertainty of the cost.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the reasons I have a lot of sympathy personally for self-employed is I grew up in Alaska, and I was a commercial fisherman. And, you know, all commercial fishermen, they're like farmers and realtors. We're all self-employed, you know. And so you're on your own, and you're at the bottom of the barrel, but you're in business. You make an investment. You get a loan. You build a fishing boat. I know you guys have all seen the deadliest catch. Well, that's what we did growing up in Alaska, and I was, you know, a commercial fisherman years. And, you know, you're on your own. And but there's self-employed people all over the country in the same boat, so to speak. They go through the same thing. They make investments. You know, and self-employed, it's one of the fastest growing sectors of our economy, you know, because, you know, computers and all cell phones and all kinds of things have led more capacity. But you are right, is that if you've got a secure job, and you got a family, you have really got to look in the mirror and say, am I going to start this business and go out on my own when I got a job? Not only do I get a steady paycheck, but I got coverage for my family.
Yep, my kids are safe.
There's a lot of, you know, entrepreneurs hanging back. And so, you know, when we look at it, we say the system is anti-entrepreneur. You know, it's not incentivizing, it's disincentivizing, you know, because, you know, it's like, why would you do that to you and your family? No, you know, so people are holding back. And, you know, when we're in a recession, that makes no sense. We need that, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit out there and people investing, taking a risk, but not like putting their family at risk. Coverage.
You know, how many people want to, you know, to take a risk to start a small business, want to put their home on the line, want to put their children's future on the line? To me, this just seems, and again, you go back to the repeal that the Republicans did in the House. What they said they were going to replace it with was common sense. Well, common sense to me is to provide a situation where people can strike out onto their own without the fear of falling and through the net.
I agree with you 100%. We need solutions. That's what small business
needs,
is solutions.
Instead of the rhetoric, we should be talking about how do we get to that place at the end of the road. Because I do believe everybody agrees on the destination. I do believe that most folks agree that everyone should have access to health care, should have security and health. The question is which path do we take to get there?
Yep, there's many paths, but you know, as long as we focus on a path to a solution for small business, that's what we're for.
Right there with you. Terry Gardner, National Policy Director, Small Business Majority. Thanks for taking time for me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Much of the success of American law enforcement can be traced to this important reality. Criminals tend to be stupid. In other words, they catch themselves. On the other hand, much of the failure of American law enforcement can be traced to another important reality. Our criminal laws tend to be stupider than our criminals. Take the Combat Meth Act of 2004. It prompted various states to set up electronic systems for limiting and tracking the sales of pseudoephedrine, the widely used cold medicine. These pills are good for easing the dripping and sniffling that come with colds and allergies. But pseudoephedrine is also good for making something bad. Methamphetamine, the savagely addictive drug that is a scourge of communities across the country, especially in rural areas. Thus, banning over-the-counter sales of pseudoephedrine and rationing the amount each customer can buy was well-intentioned. But restricting its sale has created a very lucrative black market for the pills, luring thousands of new peddlers, hustlers, and opportunists into the illicit meth underworld. Meth brokers and producers recruit legions of friends, homeless people, college kids eager for quick cash, and even their own children to go pharmacy to pharmacy, with each smurfer, as they are called, buying the limit on pills. Using store specials and even clipping coupons, they can buy a box of pseudoephedrine for $8, then sell the pills to meth producers for $50. That's a nice profit for 30 minutes or so of their time. This is Jim Hightower saying, so while this drug war on cold pills has added inconvenience to legitimate customers and expense to pharmacies, it has failed to curb the meth trade and has created a booming new network of black market criminals for the police to chase. Can we now admit that this is stupid and try something else? Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side.
I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody, everybody, let's get into it. Get stoned, get started, get started, get started. Let's get it started.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Here at Families USA, the conference in Washington, D.C., talking about health care and all things that is health care. I'm sitting here with Joan Fitzgerald. She's the president of America Votes. Joan, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
You look at this conference, and a lot of energy, a lot of positive things coming out of this. What are you hoping to gain from the conference here today?
I'm hoping that there's a much wider, deeper discussion about what the health care bill that was passed last year means to American families and the positive points that people should, not be willing to give up as we go through this new Congress taking a new look at repeal of the health care bill.
The job destroying, killing, mutilating health care bill law act amendment?
Yeah, the one that allows people to keep their kids on until they're 26. And
how dare they?
Yeah, how dare they? We never thoroughly discussed the provisions of the bill that were helpful to families, and we need to have a very robust discussion of that.
But in thinking about that, and I go back to the infamous quote of Nancy Pelosi saying, once people learn what's in it, they're going to love it.
Right.
Shouldn't we have learned about it first? Process have been right up front?
We should have been pushing back just as hard as they were pushing to undermine it and say, people need the ability to buy health insurance when they have pre-existing conditions. Insurance is supposed to be spreading the risk, and frankly, it was just keeping the profits for themselves for insurance companies. They wanted no risk. They wanted the healthiest populations.
They have no risk, really. I mean, if you stop and think about it, we've got a system before this bill of the insurance companies could pick the healthiest people. And we, the taxpayers, through Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, we covered the people who needed health care, who use health care, the children,
right.
the old people, and sick people.
Right.
So how do I get an industry? How do I start a business where I can only cherry pick certain things?
You need a lot of lobbyists here in D.C. That's your first step.
Well, again, in looking at this law that was passed and that the Republicans want to burn down and steal from us, there are a lot of good things there. And I learned something today that, there's a small business pool as well that I didn't know was part of this law. I think at some point this could be that moment where the entrepreneurial spirit of this country ignites and we see the small businesses growing again and we see job creation. As we're told, if small businesses are the engine of job creation, here's an opportunity for that.
The larger the pool of people, the lower the risk. And allowing small businesses to pool together and like businesses is a tremendous step forward. We are a coalition of progressive organizations, some of whom are labor unions who have been fighting long and hard for health care reform in this country. And we have the ability to target voters who care about health care and mobilize them. And in the states that America Votes is in, Pennsylvania being one of them, getting that word out to the people who care the most and having them show up in Harrisburg and having them talk to their state reps about whether or not they think it's appropriate that they should undo the federal legislation at the state level.
Yeah,
really important.
There have been several groups who are holding rallies. The new governor is going to do away with adult basic, which is one of the health insurance programs for people who aren't low income enough to get health insurance. They're just on that border.
Right.
Going to take that away. And it was a very reasonable cost. Going to take that away, put them into a private plan, which is going to cost four times as much. To me, it doesn't seem all that bright, but that's the direction our governor wants to take us.
Yeah, the cost containment on the insurance company side, we've had very little leverage on that. And I know a lot of my partner organizations were very sad to see the public option part of this dropped.
I was one of them.
It was the one thing that was going to help contain costs and keep costs reasonable for people who work for a living.
It goes back to your idea, what you said earlier about pooling risk.
Yes.
Because for me, I think we all have to be in this. And it can't be, we hear the conservatives, one of their main themes of their whole party is this idea of personal responsibility and individual mandates and all. To me, it seems reasonable to mandate people get coverage, that you be responsible enough for yourself to make sure that you're covered.
And the flip side of that is to make sure that it's affordable enough for people.
Well, absolutely.
And I always thought that the public option was going to be the fallback to make sure that there was a reasonable gauge out there as to what health care should cost. You don't have to buy it, but you ought to have that option, and it would hold down the prices of insurance companies that, frankly, have raised costs in the teens, 15, 16, 17% a year without having to lay out why exactly their costs have gone up.
So you wouldn't have been in favor of a mandate then?
I'm okay with a mandate as long as there was a public option. Put it this way.
Right.
For me personally, I want to see how this plays out to make sure that people can afford what is going to be in front of them without a public option.
Good point. But for me, you know, I look at it, unless everybody's in this, unless we have a buy-in by everyone, I think you're going to have a problem, because you're going to end up having you, me, other folks paying for people who are free riders.
Well, and kind of worse than that, I mean, there's a whole population that typically have not been able to afford health insurance. You know, kids just out of college or out of high school who are working for the first time who may not be covered by their jobs. And they are sort of the bulletproof generation, if you want to call it that. They don't think anything bad will ever happen to them. They also happen to be the healthiest people in the insurance pool.
Right.
And we need them to be insured to drive down the cost for people who are getting older or people who have pre-existing conditions. When you spread the risk, you need healthy people in the pool.
Because you know, here's a little shocker. Those people are going to end up being 40, 45, 50.
Right.
They're going to get there eventually.
They will.
Part of having this social, and a lot of people hate that word social, but having this social system that we're all a part of.
Absolutely. And, you know, we fail to see that there are people who cannot get insured, who through no fault of their own, through the unlucky gene pool, have gotten, you know, genetic illnesses that they have to deal with. And, you know, we all ought to step back and say, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. And it could be me tomorrow. I could step in front of a bus and be somebody who needs, yep, you know, extraordinary care. We should have that attitude, and instead we don't. We have this attitude, every man for himself. Well, frankly, that's not what insurance is supposed to be about.
Yeah, and again, you know, I love this argument that, oh, this is this grand socialist plan. The socialists are taking over. But, you know, isn't risk pooling basic socialism, if you think about it? Once you start an insurance company, aren't you talking about the common good at some level?
Well, you should be, unless you're talking about corporate profits and the bottom line, and how do we minimize the common good in this and maximize profits by eliminating anybody who might ever have to cash in on a policy. And that's frankly where we've been, and that's where the frustration was, which led to this health care bill.
Yeah, you know, one of my problems with the way things used to be pre the Affordable Health Care Act is that, you know, as you got older, insurance companies had an incentive not to provide you with care, not to give you testing strips so you could test your diabetes,
right,
not to keep track of things, because eventually you're going to be on the back of the taxpayers.
Right.
Let them deal with you. And this kind of, I think, changes that a little bit.
Well, the fallacy, too, has been that a lot of the things that have been mandated, like mammographies and screenings for cancer, were exploding costs. They were actually saving money, because
of course they are.
You were getting to problems before they developed. And that is part of good health care. And it's part of a system that enables us to be a healthier nation.
Well, do you remember the meme where they were coming out and they're going, you know, then people are going to go to the doctor more. If they have health insurance, they're going to go to the doctor more. And my first thought was, A, no, because I've got the best health care money you could buy, and I don't go to the doctor even if I need to half the time. And B, don't we want people going to the doctor more often? Because maybe if you catch it early, you know, that whole ounce of prevention,
right,
thing that we used to believe back at the founding. You want to talk about the founding fathers? You know, maybe that ounce of prevention thing, maybe there's something to that.
When I was president of the Senate in Colorado, we looked at things from a standpoint of what's outcome-based medicine and how do you get the best outcome?
Death panels.
Right, how do you get
death
the
panels.
How do you get the healthiest people? And, you know, part of that is providing incentives for people to use things like screenings and making sure that people understand what their health condition is and try to contain things that are not going well. But it was all lost in a debate of ridiculous proportions,
yep,
about death panels and end-of-life issues that...
Well, you've got to be honest, the end-of-life thing makes sense to me. I look at that whole Terry Schiavo thing and, you know, make me run right out and make sure that my wishes were known. I think that for a lot of people it did it. And to me, that part of the bill is, to use a Republican frame, it's common sense. You know, I know they repealed the job-killing, destroying health care bill act, law, whatever it was that they named it, because it, in place of common sense. But this seems to make common sense to me.
You know, from every aspect, we needed a health care bill. We needed probably more than we got, a lot more than we got. And I know that, you know, our brothers and sisters in labor have, part of their negotiations every time they went to the table was about providing adequate health care for their workers and their retirees. I mean, it's part of a healthy lifestyle in all ways.
Yeah, you cannot possibly be in the middle class in this country without health security, however you want to put it.
Well, I mean, you can worry yourself to death about what happens if I get sick. If I have insurance, I may find out I only have an insurance policy. I don't actually have health care because of denials. And so, you know, submitting claims and getting denied and then having to, you know, push that and before panel after panel to make sure that they pay your claim. No one talked about this when the bill was going forward, about how we had actually gotten ourselves into a position of paying for a health care that was subject to the whim of the insurance provider as to whether or not when you needed it, they'd pay for it. And I'm hoping that the conference here today, you know, invigorates people to have this discussion about the injustice of paying premiums your whole life and then finding that there's some caveat that they're not going to cover whatever it is you just
exactly.
got.
You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about here, and I've talked to several people who are, you know, they're excited that they've got the bill, and you know, it's almost like mission accomplished. And what I'm afraid of is that, you know, you're going to have this, and I'm kind of glad that the Republicans want to burn it down and want to destroy it, because maybe it will keep people like you and other folks here invigorated and moving towards fighting for something better, because I don't think this isn't the best thing in the world. But it's a step in the right direction. It's a step in that direction.
Right. I mean, every state, Colorado had something on the ballot. You know, did the state of Colorado want to withdraw from the federal health care bill? They actually rejected that in the last election. As bad as that election was on so many fronts, people saw the value of keeping the federal bill alive.
That says a lot.
Yeah, I think it does. And I think we're going to see state chambers, you know, trying to dismantle this federal health care bill. And what we're really going to need to do, we, America Votes as an organization, is to mobilize those voters that have cared for years about the state of American health care and make sure that their voices are heard as well as people who are angry on the other side.
And keep fighting to improve what we have and make it better. Because I look at Medicare. You know, it wasn't what it was when it started.
Mm-hmm.
It took generations of people pushing and fighting for something that has turned into what I think is one of the best social policies that we've had in generations.
You know, we used to have a country where the elderly, you know, lived and died in poverty and died needlessly from diseases that are totally preventable. And certainly that's not what we envision the future for our parents and ourselves to be. And we're better than that as a nation, and we ought to act like we're better than that.
I sure hope so. Joanne Fitzgerald, President of America Votes, I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Thank you.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Your Working Class Radio Experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and prosperous. Father, son, let the cameo, blue dental, head is vain. Oh, he's a working class man. Or else she's gonna cut his balls off now with a 6-inch carving knife. Hey, what?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're at the Families USA Conference talking about health care. You know, it's easy to forget about the outside world. We're talking about health care. We're talking about things that happen here at home. So it's easy to forget that there's someone outside of our borders. There are people outside of our minds that need help. That's why I've asked Chad Bissonette to come sit. He's the co-founder and executive director of Roots of Development. Chad, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you.
I'm looking at the stories after the tragedy there in Haiti. What are the conditions right now?
Conditions are very challenging, to be totally honest. It's one of the only places I've been in a long time where the situation is actually worsening. It's getting worse, and I don't mean just because of that earthquake. Things were pretty bad before the earthquake. They've gotten worse since the earthquake with the cholera, and the situation is very difficult. Certain fundamental things have to change that were one way before the earthquake and remain the same after the earthquake.
Such as?
Such as a different way to approach the resources that get put into the country. Tons of resources, as we know, go into that country, either through the government, bypass the government, through non-governmental organizations. But they're really not focused on sustainable long-term impact. They're focused on dealing with things that are quick fixes. Now, this seems simple to most of us that that's not the way to go about doing these things, but the disconnect between those who give the money and where it actually gets to is large. And so the problem in that disconnect is that eventually the structure falls apart.
Right.
And that money is used for things that aren't actually causing long-term sustainable change.
Who's responsible for that? I mean, how do you change it?
Everybody. To tell you the truth, I mean, if we're talking on a large scale, the keys to this country's, to changing this country and improving the situation down there is two: security and employment. Now, unfortunately, one goes with the other.
Right.
If you don't have security, people aren't going to invest. People aren't going to come in and say, I've seen it. You go up one of the major artery roads in the city called Delma. That's a place where there has been a lot of investment, a lot of businesses. Well, every time there's a food riot because people can't afford food put on their table, every time there's an election issue, riots go on all throughout the street and people's businesses are destroyed. If there's no security, people aren't going to invest in the country. At the same time, if there's no employment, you're going to lack security, because if people can't get food on the tables, they're going to do whatever they can
Absolutely.
To make it happen. So, but those are two issues. Got to address security, and at the same time have to address getting investment into that country and securing it and making sure that it can thrive, it can create jobs, and those are the two big things. But if you ask whose responsibility is all of that, at this point, it has to be everybody's. The Haitian government does not have the capacity to do this on their own. NGOs don't have the capacity to do it on their own, and it shouldn't. A lot of this work shouldn't be work of the NGOs. However, some people say we've got to, look at the NGOs that exist there, figure out who's really doing good long-term work and who's not. Pull out the ones that aren't. We can't yet do that. That's
right.
A good goal for long term, but if we pull a lot of those NGOs out that are doing certain work that's keeping some people alive and the government doesn't have the capacity to do it, it's not going to be good. It's going to make things worse. So, but at this point, it is everybody's responsibility. It's the Haitian population. Many of them understand what they want. They're not quite sure. They're disconnected from the actual resources that come in. And that's on a small scale. That's exactly what we do. We directly work with the communities that receive the resources that we connect from the United States and put into Haiti. We don't make any of the decisions about what projects are done. Funny enough, almost all the projects that are outlined by these communities have to do with health. The first project that was outlined by the communities we work with was clean water. We ended up helping them build a municipal water facility. It's the largest water spring on the particular island we work on, off the mainland of Haiti, called La Gonave. After we completed that, the community sat down with diverse representatives from the community and asked, when I asked what should we do next, they said, well, access to basic health care. The beginning was addressing the clean water issue.
Right.
Now they want to expand that and try to figure out how do we get at least some type of first step to handling our health issues.
Is making sure the things you're ingesting aren't killing you.
Yeah, I mean, people down there, I've lived down there for a year. I travel down there every 2 months. These people have become my second network, my second group of friends, a family of all that. And everybody is sick down there. It's bizarre. Everybody is sick. And sure, some of them are sick with some very intense illnesses, but many of them are sick with stuff that no one would ever be sick with here.
Such as?
Everybody I know has had malaria at some point. That's something that you can prevent. Typhoid fever. Fevers, just regular fevers all the time. Malnutrition. There are enough resources in the world to deal with all of these issues.
And I would argue probably there's enough money donated to take care of these as well. You know, I was reading an article
Absolutely.
Recently that said there's a potload of money that hasn't been allocated. And the rationale is, well, you know, into a country like that, we can't pour the money in because it could be ill spent. But you have people who are sick from, as you're saying, headaches, from fever, from, you know, simple things that we could help prevent.
All of the reasons that you hear people talk about why the situation hasn't changed, I say, if I've mentioned this to several people, I said, if you had taken a photo of some of the public spaces, which are now homes to tent camps, about 2 or 3 weeks after the earthquake, and you went down there today, after a year after the earthquake, and you took photos of those same locations, they're going to be the exact same photos you took a year before. In fact, I was just there 2 weeks ago, and I saw them building permanent walls around these tent camps that have taken up public spaces. Now, people are talking about these tent camps as as short-term, not permanent. If they're not permanent, you don't put up permanent walls to protect these tent camps in these public spaces. There's a major disconnect between what's actually being talked about here, where the resources are saying are going, and what's actually being done. And it's unacceptable. It's absolutely, and a major thing you can do is there are large institutions, for example, the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund, that are really investing in some impressive stuff. They're working very hard. There are a lot of challenges and a lot of needs in that country. They are working very hard to cut the fat and really say, we're going to put the money that we've collected, that people have donated to us, to things that are going to have long-term effects and a great impact in this country. They're a great example. You have other smaller organizations, medium-sized organizations, that the key to figuring out who you should support down there and where you should put your resources is how much of an involvement do the Haitian people have in managing that development. That's key, because they know best how to use those resources. People are worried about doing that because they believe that the wrong decisions would be made. I'm not talking about government officials that can be corrupt because of the circumstances, because of the environment down there. I'm talking about community groups. Right. That have been wanting to do this, have formed together with very little resources from a long time ago.
I was going to ask you about that. If the people down there know that well, why didn't they do it beforehand? Because Haiti has been a very poor country for a very long time.
You mean the populations, right?
Yeah,
the community groups?
Yeah.
Because they've got the drive. They know what they want to do. They know what would make a difference. They're not connected to the resources. Again,
so out of this
disconnect.
Tragedy now, maybe you can get the resources to these people.
That's exactly what we've been doing. That's what we did before the earthquake. What we realize is it's the key. I traveled a lot before I started this organization. In fact, when I first started traveling to Haiti, I never imagined starting an organization like this doing this. But I saw a lot of development money going into countries, poor countries. I saw a lot of development projects. I saw many that were very large, very expensive projects that had very little impact,
okay, right.
Or fell apart after about a year or two of them. And when I started asking myself the questions of why are some of these successful, why are some of them not successful, I realized what it primarily had to do with was the degree of involvement of the communities in their own development, then connecting the bigger resources to them and helping them build a structure for them to manage those resources effectively. If you do that well, that's the key. Because I've seen it, that we planted some resources into one, I call it a seed on this particular island. We planted the seed. Without even having an idea that this would happen, this has quickly changed this particular community. It started overwhelmingly moving into other neighboring communities and started to branching out without our direct involvement. Because other community groups are seeing that what this community group is doing, they're managing their own development with necessary resources coming in. They're now sending delegations to this group and saying, how do we get involved in this? This is key.
It's absolutely.
What you can do is you can basically by empowering or building the capacity of local community groups that understand all the things that us foreigners or us big institutions don't understand because it's not our country, it's not our place, it's not our challenges. If you build a good enough structure, inject those resources, you're basically creating a cluster of communities that then start expanding on their own beyond you. Which that's independence, that's sustainability.
And as I've always said, that's how you change the world. You change your little piece of it, and maybe the community down the road sees, hey, they're doing a good job, we're going to do the same thing. And that's how you, absolutely, I agree with you 100% there, Chad Bissonnette, co-founder and executive director of Roots of Development. In moving forward now, some of the problems we've identified that maybe the money's not getting in there quick enough. There's some obstacles there. Where do you see this going in the next year, 5, 10, as we move forward? Because, as I'm looking at this, you haven't painted a great picture of success here moving forward.
Now, if I was a politician, I've heard no matter what, going into an election, even if you think you're going to lose, you're not supposed to say you're going to lose, and you're supposed to say, no, we've got a good shot, we're going to win this. That's not the case. I'm not a politician, and I'm not walking into this thing in that regard. I'm looking at it realistically. This is not a joke, and it's not a small challenge to address. This country is going to be in tough shape for some time now because, again, a lot of the resources going into this country are going into either the hands of people who don't know who abuse those resources. A lot of the resources go into the hands of people with huge hearts who want to be involved in stuff, who are making sacrifices, who are doing great things, but don't understand the keys to development. Those resources are meant to develop this country, to help the population improve their situation, improve the country as a whole. Not just for good intentions, and there's a lot of good intentions that are keeping the status quo or making things worse to a certain degree, because you build structures of dependency, and then when they fall apart, the people are in a worse situation. It's going to be tough, but hopefully those who are making an impact, their voices are heard more often, so that people on this end of things, people who are giving, who are following the situation, who care about it, even those people with good hearts that are working down there, can learn and can have a chance to see or figure out how they can do things better. And I think the key is, as I said, on a large scale, which is not something that Roots of Development necessarily works on, but on a large scale, addressing maybe the Haitian government, foreign governments, our own government here in the United States, large institutions, we've got to better address and really put our time, energy, and money focused on security. Now, I'm risking a little bit in saying this, but the United Nations peacekeeping troops have been down there since 2004, I believe. They have done some positive things. They've cleaned up a lot of the slum areas. They've dealt with a lot of the drug lord issues and things like that. The country's security situation has gotten worse. Now, it's not their fault. It's due to many different things.
Poverty
and illness, sickness and cholera and earthquakes and things like that. However, since 2004, for their presence to be there, and they're one of the primary things to deal with security, it's not working. Now, if this was my company, and you had a certain thing in your company that wasn't working,
you get rid of them.
You deal with it. You got it. I may not be able to sit here today and say, this is what you need to do. This is how you need to replace them, because I don't deal with security. But something's not working. And real security has to be addressed. And it has to change quickly, because in order for investment to come in, the security situation has to be there. I propose perhaps an idea, throwing it out there, is that we get investors. Haiti has cheap labor, right? It's a place where it used to be, I think maybe about 5, 10, 15 years ago, it was the number 3 assembly country for the United States. We buy our parts cheap from right. Southeast Asia, bring them to Haiti. They'd assemble them there for cheap. It was creating a lot of employment. Conditions wouldn't be up to par on what we'd hope for here in this society. But I believe there's stepping points. There's you take each step one after another in order to get where ideally where you want to be. It created lots of employment. I live with and I have friends that are regular Haitian residents, and they will tell me, Chad, we need employment.
I agree that you need employment. Where I will disagree is I don't think we need to lower our standards or lower what we would expect for them. I think we should bring them up to our standards.
Absolutely.
Instead of the other's take on it.
But I'm not saying abuse the situation. I'm saying find it. Yeah, absolutely. And that was the case. And that's why, for example, a former president of Haiti pushed to raise the minimum wage. And a lot of people disagreed with that and said, do not raise the minimum wage. A lot of these people investing in this country, these companies are going to go elsewhere, where the payment that they can make, the salary they can give people, is going to be lower. I say find a happy medium.
Right.
Find a happy
right.
medium. Bring in investment. Put it a little on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince, where there is less likely you're less likely to have insecurity. Build big businesses, assembly plants, things like that, and have secure ways to transport your workers back and forth from these facilities. They're going to have jobs. It's going to help the country as a whole in terms of employment, investment. You're going to deal with the security situation, so these companies aren't faced with their business being looted or their business being destroyed, and them having to put a lot of money over and over again to rebuild their walls, to rebuild their whatever the case may be, and take these small steps in order to make that happen. Again, this is not what I work in. I do rural development. I work with community capacity building. But that's one component that we're addressing. Another component is on the large scale way. And security and employment are the two keys.
Not just there, but just about everywhere.
Yeah.
Chad Bisonette, co-founder and executive director of Roots of Development. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much
for filling us in on this.
Absolutely.
The defenders of faith, I will be long. To the last of us, fight till we die. To the king of the kingdom. We'll be right back.
Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Public services and the public worker wages and pensions that make them possible are manageable, sustainable, and are not a burden that taxpayers can no longer afford. That's not coming from a union spokesman. Those are the views of the Fiscal Policy Institute's Dr. James Parrott.
There's no question about it. We have severe budget problems, but I think it's manageable. It's essential to maintain these as part of the retirement security safety net. We can maintain the integrity and the value of public pensions as an essential part of the retirement security system. There's clearly an opportunity to ask high-income people in New York to contribute their fair share to a solution. The public sector unions will do their part.
Dr. Parrott says slashing government spending will actually hurt the economic recovery.
If the response at this point is to really put the screws to state government budgets, to cut that spending, to lay off public sector workers, that's only going to keep us mired in this severe economic downturn for that much longer.
States are continuing to struggle with ways to bridge massive budget deficits, and it's often falling on workers to take the brunt of the cuts. Jesse Russell reports.
Kansas is one of a number of states trying to figure out how to close a major budget deficit. That state is staring down a $550 million deficit, and a new plan from a legislative panel could see state workers taking it in the wallet to help close the gap. The proposal would see a 7.5% pay cut for state workers over the next handful of months leading up to the end of the fiscal year. As a result, the state would save $8 million. Organizations representing state workers have expressed concerns with the proposed plan, saying it comes at a time when more social services are needed due to the very same financial collapse in the private sector that created the budget shortfall in the first place. Meanwhile, a proposal in New York State to freeze state worker pay may have received a boost from a Quinnipiac University poll. According to the poll, 75% of voters said they agree with the wage freeze plan by Governor Andrew Cuomo. The plan would see workers' wages frozen for 1 year in an attempt to cut costs. However, that's mostly it for public support of Cuomo's plans. 79% are against cutting school aid, 69% want to leave Medicaid untouched, and 55% said hands-off pensions. Voters also want taxes left alone, with 66% opposing increases. 60% said they would prefer the elimination of services over a tax increase.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
coming here talking a little bit about this. I've got Congressman Joe Crowley here with us from New York's 7th District. Congressman, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick. Good to be with you.
Yeah, I'm looking at the health care job killing, destroying Amendment Act bill. Not sure what the title is at this point anymore, the way they've changed it. And I go, more divisiveness? Do we need that right now?
Well, obviously, I don't think we need it. I think what we accomplished in the last Congress was substantial. It was probably the most productive Congress in the history of our country in many respects, and that we adopted legislation that will actually change people's lives for the better. You know, I don't see anything in H.R. 1, that's what I call it. It's their first bill, the very first bill that my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle introduced and put on the floor. There was nothing in that bill that would create a single job. Nothing in that bill that will reduce the deficit by a single penny. Nothing in that bill that will improve the lives of working Americans and the middle class of this country. So for the life of me, I don't know what the game plan is, except that I know it's red meat to their base. It's red meat to the Tea Party folks. And we, God bless them, they have their issues in their own party for the first time. It's really evident. Democrats, we've been known to be all over the place, but to see the Republicans actually divided right now warms my heart a little bit, you know. So, but, you know, nothing I've seen in any of the first 10 bills that comes to my mind that does anything that I talked about before. This health care bill, for all its inadequacies that people point out, and on the left and the right, we can talk about that, but it will create 4 million jobs over the next 10 years. It will decrease the deficit by $230 billion in the first 10 years, and over the next 20 years by $1.3 trillion. So this is going to reduce the cost to people in this country in terms of their health care. It's going to improve their lives, improve their health care as well. For the life of me, I think they should get off this, get back on the issues that people care about. That's job creation.
Absolutely.
That's the economy, making it work for them and not just for Wall Street.
Yeah, this, I think most people realize this was just a political ploy.
Mm-hmm.
They ran on it. They had to get it out of the way. And now they've done that. They've wasted taxpayers' money. They've wasted time.
Yep.
But they had their political moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for me, it's about how do we move this forward? There's a lot of things that, you know, I don't agree with the bill.
Yep.
And there's a lot of things that I'm sure they don't agree. How do we make this better? How do we go forward instead of going backwards? Let's and just say, well, repeal it.
Yep.
And replace it with what? Oh, common sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What the hell is that?
Well, the reality is, though, that there doesn't seem to be much of an effort on the other side to really address this issue at all.
Right.
Things were fine as they were. You know, exponential increases in your health insurance, 25-40%, that's fine. You know, there wasn't any. For all the years that they controlled the House of Representatives, they did nothing to address the issue of the rising cost of health insurance in this country. Certainly did nothing to expand the opportunities for people heretofore who haven't been able to afford to purchase their own insurance, the opportunity to do that. All they've been able to do is take shots at what we've been able to accomplish. I think the risk for them really is the more the bill is implemented, the more the people understand what's in this bill, the more they like this bill. They may not love it, but they're going to like a lot of aspects of it. They're going to like the fact that their children under 26 can stay on their insurance. They're going to like the fact that if they have a child with a pre-existing condition, that that child cannot be disenrolled from or not get insurance in the first place. They're going to like the fact that the lifetime cap has been eliminated in terms of what can be spent on their insurance. They're going to like the fact that insurance companies have to spend 80% of what they derive in payments on health care and not on other expensing. So, and I can go on and on and on. And it, what's really critical here, Rick, is that people in 2014 are going to be able to have insurance that they can buy. And it's going to be comparable to what members of Congress get, because in 2014, Rick, we have to enter the exchange. And I think it's fair. I think it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that. All of the congressmen who have come in, how many of them have said that they're not going to take the health care that's provided?
It's interesting you bring this up. I was the one who challenged them on this. I said, if you ran against the health care bill and you vote for repeal, are you going to accept your own government-supported health care? And I have to tell you, there are 8 souls out there who said that they will turn down the coverage. But what's interesting, Rick, what's important to point out, is that unlike those 43 million Americans who don't have access to health care today, that through this bill ultimately will be able to purchase their own Plan A. They're not going to have a Plan B.
Right.
And these members of Congress, each and every one of them, has a Plan B. Either they were a retired military personnel and they have vet care, or they are a former state legislator, they can get their state benefits, or they're independently wealthy and they have their own, they can purchase insurance on their own, or they have a business through which they could still maintain their business, or their spouse has insurance, or for some, they're going to sleep in their offices so that they can save money and buy the health care for their family. I don't deny. I want them to have health care. I don't want them to deny the health care.
I want everybody to have health care.
They should have it, but they should be willing to give to themselves what they will afford to the American people as well.
I'm right there with you. At the end of all this, Congressman, you know, I look at the – I wish the president would have pursued a bolder economic plan right from the beginning instead of going after health care. I think when you create jobs and you have an economy that's growing and prosperous, these other problems are easier to solve. Where are we going to be going from this point forward to begin to create jobs?
Yeah.
I know there's been talk of building high-speed rail. Mm-hmm. There's talk of broadband, but I'm not seeing the urgency that I think has to happen to get us at least up to the level of where the Chinese are going.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any question that it's clear who we're competing with. And it's, you know, in New York, we always concerned about New Jersey. But today, that's not the case anymore. It's not about New Jersey. It's not about Chicago or L.A. It's about China. It's about Europe. It's about India. It's about developing parts of this country, of this world, that have, in a very short period of time, have figured out how they can compete in a global way. And we're at a disadvantage in that respect. So we've been sleeping behind it. We've been caught behind the eight ball. What the president talked about here was a Sputnik moment. Now, it's not as if a rocket has gone into outer space and we're all nervous about what that means. But in essence, that's what's happened. The Chinese are in outer space, man. They are looking at things that they weren't looking at 10, 20 years ago. They're trying to capture the solar panel market in the world today in terms of manufacturing. That's something that we developed. It was developed here in America first. 90% of the development of solar paneling has taken place outside the United States today. What I think is important, the president talked about infrastructure. Critical infrastructure is needed in this country to be reinforced. I remind my colleagues that the former chairman of the Infrastructure and Transportation Committee in the House of Representatives, Jim Oberstar, was from Minnesota. It was in Minnesota where that bridge collapsed. It doesn't leave me with a warm and fuzzy feeling back home in New York when I hear about that.
Especially going over the GW.
Correct. No question about it. Or going over the 59th Street Bridge. I mean, that thing was built in the 1890s, you know. But they built them good back then. But the reality is that we need to address those critical infrastructure needs for our national security, for our trade, for whatever it may be, but it's also going to put people back to work.
Yep.
That's critical. What I think is also important for the president to express, and for our constituents, my constituents in the Bronx and Queens to understand, green jobs are great, but we think of that as being about California, about the Sun Belt, and Florida, and Texas, Arizona. What does it mean for us in New York? What does it mean in Ohio? What does it mean in Maryland? What does it mean in Michigan? Are those green jobs going to be there for us as well? And explain how we're going to fit into this. I think the president also got the critical point about education. We are falling behind education tremendously. In parts of my district, kids just aren't graduating. And what happens then? They have no lives. They get involved in drugs. They get involved in crime. And it costs us more to incarcerate than it would be to educate. And it's incredible. But that's what we need to focus and address, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting you brought up, you know, the 59th Street Bridge, the GW, all of this stuff that were done generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the investment that generations ago did that we haven't been doing. And I, one of my greatest fears is that when my children get to be my age, what have I built for them?
Mm-hmm.
And how bad is it going to be then?
Right.
Because, you know, look around in Pennsylvania. A good half of the bridges are deficient.
Right, right.
And it could be any day that, you know, we have an I-35 in Pennsylvania or New York or any of the states that are seeing their infrastructure crumbling because we're not investing.
Not maintaining it and modernizing it. Modernizing as well. I mean, this whole notion of rejecting money to build high-speed rail in Ohio.
Or Wisconsin,
wherever it may be. I mean, it's just to me is ludicrous. You know, this is what government can help develop. If it was something that could catch on the private sector, they'd have done it long ago.
Absolutely.
If this is a moneymaker, they'd have done it on their own. But, you know, apparently this needs to have government incentivizing. And we're willing, you know, this president's willing to do that. We need to work in partnership with governors that will do this as well to help these states. I mean, what else? We have to attract reasons to do business in Ohio. It's moving elsewhere. To do business in Wisconsin, to do business in Michigan, upstate New York. Once this is where it all happened, the Industrial Revolution, that's over. And we got to find ways to create a new revolution in these states to bring that populace back. We were losing it.
I agree.
But it's not just about our states and not just about losing it to other states. It's about we're losing this game worldwide.
Well, what we're losing, and I think what we've lost, is leadership and vision. The ability to see down the road and say and have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk about the Chinese, and you brought they actually have a plan for the next 25, 100 years, which focuses on destroying us, I think. But we don't seem to have that. We have this invisible hand mentality that, well, it'll take care of itself.
Right.
And we're beating each other up, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, even before we get to the global marketplace.
We're trying to rob each other of the jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great things is Steny Hoyer has been talking about this, and our caucus has been, make it in America. I believe that tremendously. It's about making it in America.
Policy. That's
policy, but it's also about manufacturing in this country. We need to manufacture more in this country.
Absolutely.
We can compete with anyone on a trade and a trade level. Having a quarter of a $1 trillion trade deficit with China every year, the country that doesn't have our greatest interest in mind, quite frankly, is just incredibly dumb. It's just dumb. And I didn't vote for the PNTR, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China. I didn't vote for WTO with China.
Well, thank you.
I didn't believe that they were politically nor economically mature enough to be dealing with us on a par. And I, unfortunately, have been panned out to be, I think, right. I didn't want to be right, but I am right on that.
But what does it say about us that we allow it to happen?
Well, you know.
And as I'm saying, it comes back down to policy.
Yep.
It's what you guys do in Washington. It's these free trade agreements that keep popping up. And while I'm not sure where you stand on South Korea, the idea that you have a 35% domestic content requirement on this agreement, to me, is just plain stupid.
I take each trade agreement as it comes up, and I try to base it on whether or not I think it's in the best interest, ultimately, of my constituency, of our country, primarily, and world diplomacy, in terms of our diplomacy around the world, geopolitics.
Sure.
CAFTA wasn't in our interest. I didn't believe it was in my interest in my constituency, nor for our country. And I'm looking, you know, I think the Korea Free Trade Agreement is a better trade agreement. It's been improved by this administration, our president. And I think that
it's a better bad, in my opinion.
It's a better bill. There's no question about what George Bush put in place. But what I think is more important right now is the president wants to double our exports. In order to double the exports, we have to make more.
If we have these trade agreements that has a 35% domestic content law on it, like the South Korean bill does, how much of that is mandating that we make it here?
Right.
I mean, what I envision down the line is we're going to be trading cars back and forth with the South Koreans, who are killing us, with 65% Chinese content, 65% Mexican content.
Right.
We're not going to benefit from that.
No, and I agree with that point, is that we do need to make more of those products here.
How do we do that? Is it calling the American businesses and saying, because I blame the American corporations for what's going on in China because they've rushed there.
But you know what the problem is going to be, Rick? In the end, it's in our interest. We have to do this because if we don't, there'll be no middle class to buy the products that we're talking about in the first place here. Right now, the scale is because we want the cheap product.
Right.
We can afford it. We want it. At some point, we'll have no job.
Yep.
Without a job, you can't afford, forget health insurance, you can't afford to buy a toothpick. So, and you know, the reality is we're sending too many raw materials to these countries, our own raw materials having sent back, marked up on us.
To me, that's the definition of a third world country.
I agree. And that's why, you know, we in the totality on these trade agreements, I don't vote for them all. I vote for some. It depends on whether or not I think it's in the geopolitical best interest of the country to do it and whether it is a good and balanced agreement. And if it's not, I vote against them. And I voted probably against more than I have voted for.
Right.
And particularly, I think, the China.
China trade bills
have just been terrible bills. So.
You know, and looking at Colombia, I mean, that's coming up.
Yeah.
I can see geopolitically us saying, yeah, that's a good idea because they're our friend. But manufacturing-wise?
Interestingly enough, with Colombia, 90% of what they have exporting to the United States is duty-free, quota-free. They can send anything here they want. It's the exact opposite for us. We can't send things to Colombia. So in terms of manufacturing, if it's made in America, it will create opportunities to send more products to Colombia. The Colombia Free Trade Agreement isn't so much about the jobs end of it here. It has more to do, I think, with the fact that you have labor organizers who have been killed.
Being thrown out of planes, sure.
They've been killed, and killed in Colombia. And I think they have. It's not just about labor.
It's about any activist.
It's about human rights, generally speaking. There's been a culture of death within that country. There's been improvements made. I think personally more improvements need to be made. I do think there needs to be substantially more improvements made. And I think we have to hold the Colombians to that. And I think the president has indicated that's what he's going to do. If this bill is going to move forward at all, they have to make discernible changes in terms of the human rights.
Last question I have for you before, I know you got to move along.
Yeah.
This health care bill, this whole thing, where are we going from here? What's the next step?
Well, it's all about the implementation. It's all from our perspective. It's about paying defense. We're in the minority now. We have to stand and defend what we've accomplished. The Republicans are going to make every attempt to try to defund aspects of this bill to make it unworkable, and try to force the president to negotiating changes into this. And we have to just stand tall. The AP poll that was out recently that indicated that 3/4 of Americans do not want this bill repealed. They not like every aspect of it, but want to see it work through. They want to see what the benefits will be. I think that's on our side. The more of the American people understand why this conference today is so important, more American families understand why this bill, it will improve their lives, the better chance we will have of sustaining it and seeing it implemented.
And the more we fine-tune it. Yeah. Congressman Crowley, I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this with Kim Bailey, Families USA. I might be down for a moment, but I always go back. It's time for war.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Much of the success of American law enforcement can be traced to this important reality. Criminals tend to be stupid. In other words, they catch themselves. On the other hand, much of the failure of American law enforcement can be traced to another important reality. Our criminal laws tend to be stupider than our criminals. Take the Combat Meth Act of 2004. It prompted various states to set up electronic systems for limiting and tracking the sales of pseudoephedrine, the widely used cold medicine. These pills are good for easing the dripping and sniffling that come with colds and allergies. But pseudoephedrine is also good for making something bad. Methamphetamine, the savagely addictive drug that is a scourge of communities across the country, especially in rural areas. Thus, banning over-the-counter sales of pseudoephedrine and rationing the amount each customer can buy was well-intentioned. But restricting its sale has created a very lucrative black market for the pills, luring thousands of new peddlers, hustlers, and opportunists into the illicit meth underworld. Meth brokers and producers recruit legions of friends, homeless people, college kids eager for quick cash, and even their own children to go pharmacy to pharmacy, with each smurfer, as they are called, buying the limit on pills. Using store specials and even clipping coupons, they can buy a box of pseudoephedrine for $8, then sell the pills to meth producers for $50. That's a nice profit for 30 minutes or so of their time. This is Jim Hightower saying, so while this drug war on cold pills has added inconvenience to legitimate customers and expense to pharmacies, it has failed to curb the meth trade and has created a booming new network of black market criminals for the police to chase. Can we now admit that this is stupid and try something else?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
I'm
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting here with Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action Wisconsin. Citizen Action Wisconsin is an issue-focused coalition of individuals, organizations committed to achieving social, economic, and environmental justice. Robert, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Rick.
You know, I look at this conference and a lot of good things going on. What are you here for?
Well, this is the biggest kind of confab of healthcare reform advocates in the states. And national healthcare reform has now gone to the state level. That's what the big decisions are going to be made. And so it's crucial for us to talk about what's going on. There are a lot of governors and legislators that have been elected in the last election that want to block reform and undermine it. And we need to compare notes and figure out how we can implement this well, because if we don't get costs under control and make quality affordable coverage available, you know, it's not going to work, and it will ultimately be repealed. And we'll have lost a huge economic opportunity and opportunity for people to have, you know, real health security.
Right. You know, I look at Wisconsin and I go, wow, they've taken a major turn to the right with the governor that you've got there.
Very much.
And I look at our governor now in Pennsylvania, Tom Corbett, a guy who signed on to the lawsuit as attorney general on one hand, yet on the other hand, he's calling, asking the president for more money to help implement. It's kind of weird.
We had a surge election. We have a lot of independent voters in Wisconsin. They surged for Obama in 2008. There wasn't enough done on the economy at the federal level, and so they voted for change again. But we elected conservative Republicans, both houses of the legislature and the governor. They ran on jobs and creating 250,000 jobs, and they have no agenda for actually doing that. And on health care, you know, Wisconsin now wants it with Paul Ryan taking the lead, who did the response to the state of the state. He had hearings yesterday on health care, and he had our new health secretary there to talk about how he's going to try to undermine health care reform implementation in Wisconsin. So we've gone from being a model state. I'm going to talk today about how Wisconsin had a blueprint, one of the best blueprints in the country for implementing health care reform. It's been taken off the state website, so we put it on the front of our website, and I'm going to talk about what other states could do with our plan that we won't be using because we have right-wing Republicans in charge of our government for the time being.
Which is the reason that I wanted to have you come on and talk about this. As we move forward, it is going to be to the states. We've seen California, Vermont moving towards more progressive, more single-payer type systems. What I'm afraid of on the state level here in Pennsylvania is the fact that we've got a guy who's really anti this bill. What happens when you have someone who's anti healthcare doing what's eventually going to have to happen?
We got a heck of a system where you pass national healthcare reform, and that's just one stage, and that goes to the states, and you have at least half the states having leaders against the law. So how do you make government work when the people running the government are against what you're trying to accomplish?
Yep.
So it's going to require, we have a law that can be enforced. There's a lot of money, so you pointed out your governor, as our governor, wants the money. Well, taking the money makes them do certain things as far as implementation.
Right.
The more they actually start working on, regardless of what their rhetoric is, actually implementing the law, the more it becomes a fait accompli, the more people say, well, you're already working on the law. What are you so against?
That's what I'm hoping.
And, you know, the repeal vote being such a dud last week in the U.S. House of Representatives is a very good sign. They thought that would be that big crowning achievement. And it was a blah because people don't even want it repealed. They want it improved, but the vast majority of people do not want it repealed. And these guys said they'd replace it with something else. There's
common
nothing
sense.
On the horizon.
They said we're going to replace it with common sense.
Yeah.
Well, and when I'm on the ground having a heart attack, I love nothing more than knowing that card in my wallet says common sense on it.
It's very 19th century.
Yeah.
It really is. So
let's talk about the plan that Wisconsin has scrapped that you put on the website that you think is the model. Where would a state? Let's take Pennsylvania. Where should Pennsylvania start?
Well, what the plan does is it lays out how you would have one easy place for people to apply for the health insurance exchanges, which are the meat and potatoes
right.
of this reform. It's a marketplace for people to get private insurance that's subsidized or to Medicaid if you're low income. So everyone goes to the same place, and it figures out what you're eligible for, gives you your options, tells you what your costs will be, what your tax credits will be, and it's all even simpler than buying something on Amazon. And so there's actually on our website a prototype of how that would work. I mean, it doesn't start till 2014, but the prototype, you can actually go through and see with scenarios how it would work for this family or that family as scenarios. And so you need that. You need that seamless, simple system. But then you need real rules for the insurance company marketplace that forbid them from all the horrible practices that upset people so much, like pre-existing condition discrimination, and debt, you know, differential rates people based on age and all
sorts
of factors.
All the other
factors. Rescissions. You need, but you also need competition between insurance companies so that they are rated based on quality and cost. The lower cost ones are cheaper for people to buy. And so you need to set it up so that the marketplace in healthcare will function and we bring costs under control and encourage quality. And it's all how the state will set up the exchange. The insurance companies don't want accountability, don't want real competition, because they want to just figure out a way to insure healthy people and not insure people who might become unhealthy or be unhealthy.
And that's one of the things I've said about our system for the longest time. What we, the taxpayers, are end up saddled with are the people who use healthcare. We have we insure children, we insure old people, and we insure sick people. So, I mean, give me an industry where I can cherry pick who the most profitable folks are and insure those. I would love that kind of a business.
We are the only country in the world that has an insurance industry based on that model. It's going to take a lot of time for them to unlearn it. Even though we're guaranteeing them business by saying everyone has to buy insurance, they're still against this because it's so ingrained in them that we're going to figure out how only to insure healthy people, right?
Yep.
And therefore have the biggest profit. And so these exchanges need to take all of that out of competition. We took child labor out of competition in this country before. If you allowed child labor, a company that used child labor had a competitive advantage over one that didn't, right? If you take all that out of competition, then all you can compete on is efficiency, cost, quality. And if it's clear what the quality plans are and they're easy to understand, some of the right-wing proposals, such as Utah, will have like 100 different plans available and with no standard, you know, benefits. What that means is you can't figure out what it is.
Exactly.
And you make the wrong choice. Oop, that kind of cancer isn't covered in this plan. How would you know? Well, that's on page 1,842.
Yep.
If you do this right, there are clear standard benefits packages that cover all necessary care, and preventive care is free. But this is going to be how the state set up the exchanges, and you should kick out the bad actors. They shouldn't get in the exchanges, shouldn't get the business. That's the stick that states need to use, and they have the power to do that under this law if they have the political will to do it and take on the insurance industry.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizens Action Wisconsin. You know, and talking about this, I hear a lot of my union friends, because we have a large union listenership. A lot of folks they've got health insurance. They're afraid, what's this going to do to us down the line? The president, in the last health care bill, there was a tax somewhere down the road, I guess 2018.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to start taxing higher benefit plans. How is this going to affect someone like me, a union member, some of our union listeners?
Well, I think the first thing
And how is this going to affect collective bargaining?
Well, I mean, it doesn't affect, you can still have the right of collective bargaining, assuming the states don't do other things, which conservatives like to see as far as taking away people's fundamental rights.
Right.
But given that, the current system is unsustainable. Union workers have taken a huge hit on their pay to afford health care because the cost has skyrocketed so much. And was in the United States, 130% increase in premiums. Since the year 2000, in Wisconsin, it's 198% increase.
Wow.
Since the year 2000. If that continues, it makes it almost impossible not to actually give wage givebacks in order just to maintain some decent level of health care. So if you start with that premise, then the question is, how do you make this work for people? One is, it's going to stabilize the whole system. And if we do it right, and we can actually have the kind of delivery system reform that could bring costs down, which would take a lot of pressure off of collective bargaining.
And maybe put a couple extra bucks in people's pockets.
Well, absolutely, because we're paying an outrage, you know, double what you pay in any other country. It affects job creation. You don't create as many jobs if you know it's going to cost you that much, just added on to the wages to provide the health care.
Sure.
And so there's a huge interest. Union members have a huge interest in making this work. We've lost a lot of manufacturing, I think, because of the health care mess.
So in looking at what happened last week with the Republicans doing the job-killing, health-care-destroying act, law, amendment, whatever the title was, claiming that this was going to kill jobs by having this health care bill, what you're saying is this movement could actually create jobs and wealth as well.
Absolutely. I mean, health care is not only is health care 18% of the economy, so you're actually, if you have more people having coverage, you're stimulating the economy, but it's a drag on job creation to have this that just outrageously high health insurance cost with no end in sight, because the rate of inflation is unbelievable, you know, over 10% a year in most cases. And so we're not going to be able to afford Medicare either. let alone good employer-based coverage if this continues. We have an estimate in Wisconsin that in another 6 years, the average family policy will cost $25,000 a year unless we have reform, absent reform. So the cost of doing nothing is huge. The benefit of doing it, if the states implement it right, is we can make it cheaper to create jobs. We make the country more competitive, and we free up more money for more jobs and more money for and more money there for decent salaries.
Yeah, and I don't understand how that wasn't the message that went out while arguing this health care bill. All we heard was death panels. The Republicans did a great job in messaging. They beat us on the message. And what I don't understand is how we lost that. Because if you look back when we started in 93, with Hillary moving towards health care, we were in a much better position then than we are now. And you go, look where we've come from then. What's 10 years going to hold? And as you pointed out, $25,000 a policy.
Well, you know, part of the problem is making abstract macroeconomic arguments is really hard with the general public. They don't think in those terms. So a death panel is more visceral, right? Oh, my God, a death panel, right? And so we didn't develop a counter message that was as powerful. The discussion of things like pre-existing conditions, right, is much more fundamental because half the people in this country have a pre-existing condition right. That could deny them coverage or get them charged a discriminatory rate. So I agree that partly they won the debate because fear works, right, when people are talking about major change, and people are cynical about government, which has been a right-wing conspiracy to undermine people's faith in government.
40 years, sure.
So then if you have the government doing the most sweeping thing it's done in 50 years, of course there are going to be qualms. But I see public opinion beginning to turn around as people have something to lose. There's a different it's different once you have to give something back. And now that we've started the first wave of reforms, people are more and more supportive, and they're against repeal. The important
right.
thing is that even though they'd like to see the bill changed or improved, I mean, it's 50-50 on that, a vast majority don't want to just repeal it.
Right.
And so I think the further we go, the harder it is to take this away. And we'll eventually get to the point we did on Medicare and Social Security where
exactly.
no one, all the people who were against it claimed they were for it.
Right.
Right?
Exactly. And the part, and I said that from the beginning, I'm not thrilled with this bill, and I'm not thrilled with the length of time it takes mm-hmm. to get implementation. But it is that first step. And we will move forward, and we will improve this as it goes ahead because it's now yours.
And this is a test of government. Can government work in the 21st century? We have this long time lag. We have the states involved. It's very complicated, right? But if, you know, and we may have a Supreme Court decision coming up on this in a couple of years as this challenge goes through the courts. If the Supreme Court says that it's not legal for the federal government to do national health care reform, they're saying it's not a relevant government in the 21st century. So if they want to bring us to the 18th century where we didn't have a health care system, you know,
well,
so,
some would argue the Roberts Court probably would want to take us.
They might. They might. That's the problem. So we think this is a frivolous lawsuit, except for the number of right-wing judges there are. And we've had two of the three judges have upheld the bill, but the third judge in Florida, who may rule any day, is apparently quite extremely right-wing. So we'll see. That should be an interesting interpretation of the Constitution.
It will be interesting. And again, it's going to come down to the Supreme Court ultimately deciding. And maybe starting this whole process over again. But then it's going to come back to the states.
Yeah.
And my concern is when you go back to the states, is this a race to the bottom policy? Will the states willing to set up the weakest systems be the ones that benefit corporations moving there and having all the flow there, if you will?
Well, there's a lot of fiscal pressure on the states, right? They're all in financial crisis because of the recession, not because of anything people in the states did, right, what Wall Street did. But there's pressure. Right now, you cannot, under the national health care law, cut kids off of health insurance through the Medicaid programs. There's a maintenance of effort requirement. You have to
right.
wait until full implementation. Republican governors are trying to push to get rid of that because they want to throw a whole bunch of kids off the Medicaid rolls so they can help balance their budgets. So that's something where Congress needs to say, heck no, and Obama needs to say, heck no. Otherwise, we actually start having an explosion of the number of uninsured before in the middle of this long implementation process. But that's what they're pushing for. They'd like to be out from under that obligation.
I'd say we've got an explosion of uninsured right now. Last I saw some 50 million people without insurance,
yep.
and that is not good for our society. It's not good for people who have insurance. It's really not good for the people who don't have it.
Well, it makes no sense. We pay double per capita when any other country spends. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and we don't cover a ton of people, and we have a ton of uninsured people, and the leading cause of bankruptcy is medical bills. in this country, even more, much more than foreclosures. It's also one of the leading causes of foreclosures, by the way, is medical bills. So it's unbelievable that we would set things up this way. This is a very, as you said, I mean, I'm a progressive. I'd like to have seen a stronger bill. This is a very centrist bill that relies upon private health insurance competing.
Yep.
You know, this is as centrist as it can be. It's been presented as socialistic. That's just, you know, a complete misrepresentation, because they know if they explain what the bill actually was, it wouldn't be seen as radical.
Well, Nancy Pelosi said that once people find out what's in it. And again, that was another messaging mistake.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Tell me what's in it. Don't tell me when I find out. Tell me what's in it and why I'm going to like it. Personally, I was a single payer fan. I thought we open up Medicare and say, Bob, Robert, you're going to pay $500 a month for your health care, and that's it. Just like any private insurance company would do, but it's going to be ours. We the people.
One of the biggest things that went wrong in this debate, there was a proposal the Senate put in at one point to reduce Medicare age down to 55. So to do this bill and to have done that, that would have been a step towards gradually bringing it to 45, bringing it to 35. Remember, Joe Lieberman stopped that, even though it was something he'd supported for over a decade.
Thanks,
vehemently.
Joe.
Yeah. Well, he's leaving us now, fortunately, at the end of his term.
Not
but
that he had a choice.
That was a huge opportunity, because who wouldn't choose Medicare? You know, and that group, 55 to 64 years old, my God, if you lose your job later in life.
They're the ones that are hurting the most.
They can't find, you know, the insurance companies won't insure them affordably, or they'll put a bunch of holes in it. So that would have been a great step. Maybe we can get back to there. But right now we have this bill we can implement, and it's on the states. You know, what people, I think your listeners should realize, is it's a state issue. State legislators should be hearing about it, not just members of Congress, and governors need to be hearing about it.
And that's why we're going to be pushing our new governor, who has done some bad things already with this adult basic, but we're pushing him in a direction to do the right thing. Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizens Action Wisconsin, citizenactionwi.org, the website. Robert, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. Great discussion.
We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Wake up in the morning, get to work and fight yourself, and then somebody tells you that you're owned by someone else. So what's it all about? It's money, work it out. The people of today are so tired of the love. Their argument for freedom is how much will it cost? So what's it all about? It's money, work it out. Money, money. All around, she's the guy before it drags you down. Now, acting a blind, doing a time. Hungry jungle hunters with one on bandit eyes. Never knows his army retreats to hide and cry. So what's it all about?
We're smart policy, and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make the way to happen.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. We're here at the Families USA Conference here in Washington, D.C. Going to be here all tonight and tomorrow. I got Kim Bailey sitting in front of me. She's the Senior Health Policy Analyst at Families USA. Kim, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure, Rick. Good morning.
A very nice conference. What are you seeing so far? This is the beginning of it. What are you seeing so far here?
We have a number of people from across the nation. We're all here to share ideas and to try to get our thinking past what's happening in the Beltway and really to the nuts and bolts of what's going on in the states and making this law work for families.
Well, so far the thinking in the Beltway, at least on the Republican side of things, is tear it down, burn it, do whatever you got to do, hit it with a hammer. Not good for the American people, but good for them, I think, politically a little bit.
Definitely not good for the American people. And our goal, really, in the next year is to really make people understand what's in the law and how it will help them. I think there's a lot of fear and a lot of misinformation, and our role is to make it understandable, digestible, get the real truth about the Affordable Care Act out.
Yeah, I got to be honest. Before the 2010 elections, I was going, please, run on taking something away. It worked for them. But as we move forward, is it really going to work when people find out what's in this bill? As Nancy Pelosi so infamously said, people will like it once they find out what's in it. Again, another messaging nightmare, but I think ultimately she could be correct.
I think she's absolutely correct. When we look at the polling data on the things that are in the law that we know people care about, getting rid of pre-existing condition exclusions, making coverage more affordable, protecting people from high health care costs so they don't go bankrupt. Everyone wants that.
Bankruptcy, you know, we've met several people over the last year who have had to file bankruptcy because of medical bills. And I got to be honest, you know, when you look at this, being sick should be the last reason I lose my home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We know there's a link between bankruptcy and foreclosure and medical problems. It's actually almost two-thirds of bankruptcies in the U.S., personal bankruptcies, are come in the aftermath of a medical problem.
So let me ask you, you guys deal with a lot of stories. What are some of the more heart-wrenching stories you've heard from people over the year?
Well, you know, honestly, I like to focus on the everyday stories. The heart-wrenching stories, you know, the really shocking ones about terrible car accidents and everything else, sometimes it's hard to relate to those as an everyday person. But we can all relate to having an insurance plan that doesn't cover something that we think they're going to, and then having $1,000 or $2,000 in bills that we just don't have room in our budget to pay. We hear from people every day who are struggling with the system. Either they don't have coverage and they're trying to find a way to get their kid to the doctor to treat asthma, or they have coverage and it's just not good enough and it doesn't cover what they need, and they're really struggling to get the care that they need. Those are the stories that I find so heart-wrenching.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I have a friend who took his daughter to a doctor, one of our doctors, and they wouldn't see her because they didn't have health insurance. And I'm going, wait a second, you're going to pay cash, but they won't see you? And he went into some story about the reason they wouldn't see him is because they didn't have health insurance. And it was this kind of role, this kind of snowball effect where you end up having to go to the emergency room.
That's exactly right. You know, people delay care or they go without it and then they get sicker. And it ends up being not only a potential catastrophic thing for the family financially and health-wise, but it's also hard in the system. When you go into the emergency room, it puts a burden on our emergency rooms. It also drives healthcare costs up for all of us who have health insurance and premium costs up because someone ends up paying for that care, and it's really expensive, and uninsured people often have a hard time paying full freight on their own.
Yeah, I look at my health insurance, $14,000 a year. It'd be nice to have some of that to put in my pocket. And I think most people who do have health insurance, who don't know what the costs are, and I think part of this whole debate that we've had, this discussion that we've had, has had people become aware of the true cost of what health care is, how much of their wages are being put towards health care, only they didn't know it in the past. So for those people, you know, what is this bill, what is this law going to do to help them? Because I think most of my friends, anyway, they have health insurance. Their employer provides it. They're in good shape. They want to keep what they've got. They don't see a problem going forward. How's this going to help them?
Well, I think what we've seen over the last number of years, as premiums rise, employers are put in a really hard position. And more employers faced with those premiums that are now $14,000 a year for a family are making tough decisions about what those plans cover. So you're seeing more costs that you as a consumer are bearing. And as that coverage erodes over time, the things that are in the Affordable Care Act that protect you out-of-pocket caps, requirements that coverage actually provide a full benefits package, requirements that, you be able to get coverage if you have a pre-existing condition. All those things are so incredibly important. The other thing I would say is a lot of folks want to, go out on their own and start a small business. And the fear of going without health insurance stops them from doing that.
That was when this first came up, that was the very first thing I talked about. One of the things this country is supposedly known for is that entrepreneurial spirit. And if you would take that, burden off of someone, worrying about if their children are going to be covered, worrying about if they're going to be covered, and give them the opportunity to go follow their passions. I think of a friend I worked with, hates driving a truck for a living, but it has great health benefits. He'd rather start a business as a contractor, but the health care costs would just kill it.
Absolutely. Or maybe he wouldn't be able to get health care wouldn't be able to get insurance because he has a pre-existing condition. Yep. This law changes that. And those are the sorts of things we need to get out and tell people so they understand and learn what this law has that they can benefit from.
Which, I listen to the Republican rhetoric going back and forth, and I go, well, if you believe that small businesses are the engine that creates
the backbone,
jobs and
yeah.
All that, isn't this a good idea?
One would think. It's a huge opportunity for small business owners and potential future small business owners.
We had done a food drive where we lived in a parking lot for a week at a local supermarket. And some of the stories that we heard coming back, people coming to us and saying, we've heard the program. Here's our healthcare story. Small business people who can now afford healthcare because it came down in half. We met a guy who couldn't get insurance. Got to get it through one of the risk pools in the state, and now he's going to live because he was able to get an operation for a cancer that he had. To me, it seems like common sense. And if you remember, if you listen to the Republicans after they passed their repeal the job destroying, job killing health care plan act bill law, I forget whatever it is. After they said that, they were going to replace it with common sense. Well, it seems to me common sense would be make sure people have health insurance.
I agree with you entirely. We really need to make sure that people have access to quality, affordable health insurance coverage. Having coverage isn't enough. You need to make sure it works for people. And that's what the Affordable Care Act does, too. It makes it work. It makes it real coverage.
And for me, again, then it comes back down to having the discussion about not just having health insurance, but actually having health care.
And access to those services.
And, you can have the best policy in the world if you don't have a doctor to go to. That's another problem. So, in looking at this from the medical profession, the doctors and the nurses, how is this going to help them? Because I have a buddy who's a doctor, and he said, he's a dentist. He said, I got into being a dentist because I wanted to work on teeth and be a dentist. I didn't want to be this business person that has to worry about billing and has to worry about compliance with all these rules and regulations. How does this help them?
There's a huge investment in education and investment in primary care, and I think that's really where we need to go. We've got a real, if you look forward 10, 15 years, we're going to have a real lack of primary care doctors in our country. We have a lot of specialists, but we don't have a lot of primary care doctors. The Affordable Care Act invests in the training of those primary care doctors and making community health clinics better funded, making the real infrastructure that Americans need to get access to the care in their communities work. It also invests in healthcare technology to make electronic medical records a possibility. And some things that, really are the nuts and bolts of our system and access to care.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Kim Bailey. We're at the Families USA Health Conference. She's a senior health policy analyst there at Families USA. Before we started the interview, you were kind of doom and gloom. And I look at this bill and the what you're talking about sounds great. Where's the downside?
Well, when I say I do doom and gloom, I quantify the problem. So I've spent the large part of my career quantifying the number of the uninsured in the country, quantifying the number of underinsured people in the country, talking about the gaps in their care, talking about bankruptcy, talking about foreclosure related to healthcare costs. When I talk about the potential for the future, I see that in the Affordable Care Act. So really, there's a lot of opportunity there and things that will help people get access to the care that they need when they need it, prevent diseases from occurring or prevent the progression of diseases that people have been diagnosed with them, and protect them from bankruptcy and foreclosure. All great things.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of a particular conservative friend of mine who listens, and all he heard you say right there was death panels.
Well.
That's all he heard.
Yeah,
How do we get through to some folks like that, or do we?
I think, you know, what we need to do is talk to our friends and neighbors. And there's only so much talking you can do, but you need to make a valiant effort as an American, an informed American. And I would encourage people to really know what's in the law, if you're interested in this, and talk about the things that are going to help people. You know, there's going to be credits to help people purchase coverage. There's going to be out-of-pocket caps for everyone so that no one has to face catastrophic health care costs associated with illness or injury. There's going to be, the elimination of pre-existing condition exclusions so that anyone, regardless of their health status, can get coverage. If you can focus on those things and talk to people and talk to your friends and neighbors about how it's going to help, it's the best you can do.
Yep.
And that's really our role.
And one of the things I've always said is that you can't possibly be in the middle class in this country without health security. Without the one, because I think the majority of us are one illness, one job loss away from catastrophe. Somehow that has happened, and this to me seems like common sense that we would help people with health security, so that when, for instance, one of the guests we've had recently, both daughters had leukemia, they end up losing their house, they end up filing bankruptcy, just a horrible tale, but it could happen to any one of us.
Well, and sadly, the thing that often happens when you get sick is you lose your job. So it's this vicious circle. And when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance coverage. And if you don't have another option out there, you're really left high and dry. And your chances of having to face bankruptcy are quite high.
So how does this move us away from an employer-based system? Because I've always thought that was the worst, most inefficient way of providing health insurance to people is through your employer.
This builds on what we currently have, and I think that's really important for everyone out there to know. The fear of change is true and real, and I think people want to keep what they like. A lot of people like their employer-sponsored insurance coverage, and you can keep that under this. So it builds on that, opening those new options so that you as an employee who have employer-sponsored coverage, your employer can keep it, you can keep that coverage. But if you decide you want to go out there and start your own small business, you have another option for coverage. That's really what this does. It creates new options.
Give me options. Excellent. Kim Bailey, Senior Health Policy Analyst, Families USA. FamiliesUSA.org is the website. We'll put a link up at TheRickSmithShow.com. Kim, thanks for taking time for us, and thanks for being bright and cheery today.
My pleasure, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Well, they're stealing down on Wall Street and in Washington, too. You know, it makes me wonder, what's a guy on Main Street to do?